Definition. Let's seek our best to move understanding order 7.3, to suspend standing order 7.1 in order to proceed with government bills.
Those in favour? Those against? Carried. A bill for an act to make provisions for the marriage of same-sex couples and for connected purposes. The Honourable the Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to make provisions for the marriage of same-sex couples and for connected purposes be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision for the marriage of same-sex couples and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Civil Marriage Amendment Act 2016.
Thank you, Speaker. I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the bill intends to give effect to the government's proposals to enable civil marriage between people of the same gender. Mr. Speaker, the first landmark moment came with the introduction of the Civil Partnership Act in 2014. There has since then been lobbying for civil marriage between individuals of the same sex to be made possible. The government's manifesto commitment in 2015 was to publish a demand paper in order to take the public views on this issue. Having taken office for a second time last November, we immediately set out to give effect to our manifesto commitment and issued the demand paper in December 2015. The response to it, Mr. Speaker, was overwhelming. Indeed, it was the largest response ever received to a government demand paper. The majority of the responses were in favour of equalising civil marriage. Since the close of the consultation period, which we even extended, and through an inter-ministerial committee headed by the Chief Minister, we have given a lot of thought and consideration to the matter. That was the importance that we have given to this process, but we also had lengthy meetings with representative groups. Marriage is a hugely important institution. This, of course, has been an important and has also been a very emotive subject, with strong views for and against. And I wish at this stage, Mr. Speaker, to thank everyone who was involved in the consultation process and has informed and guided with their different views and indeed valuable insights. It is important for us to strike the balance which provides equality and respecting individual beliefs. Mr. Speaker, this bill will enable same-sex couples to enter in a civil ceremony. That is, Mr. Speaker, a civil ceremony in a registry office or other approved place, whilst protecting and promoting religious freedom. I wish to make that point very clear, Mr. Speaker, that this is about civil marriage and not holy matrimony or any other religious marriage, and I will explain certain religious safeguards, particularly those we introduced following our consultation process in a moment. We believe, Mr. Speaker, that opening up marriage to all couples demonstrates society's respect for all individuals, regardless of their sexuality, making our society fairer and more inclusive for all its members. This change strengthens the vital institution of marriage and ensures that it remains an essential building block of modern society. Turning to the formalities of the bill, Mr. Speaker, the amendment to the Marriage Act introduces two new definitions, party and relevant marriage. These are introduced in Section 2 in order to give effect to the provision allowing for same-sex marriage. The term party had to be defined as a remuneration person was within the Act and made the definition was afforded to. In order to avoid uncertainty or any ambiguity given the extension of marriage to same-sex couples, this had to be addressed and if male means opposite sex and same-sex couples. The other definition was included in section 2 was the relevant marriage, meaning a marriage of a same-sex couple. Two further amendments are made after section 6 and section 40 respectively, with the introduction of new sections 6A, 6B and 38. Section 6A, Speaker. The existing section 6, subsection A, which deals with marriages solemnized or contracted in a place of worship, is slightly amended so that it is now subject to the provisions contained under the new section 6A. Section 6A relates to marriage of same-sex couples in a place of worship, and it reads as follows. Marriage of same-sex couples in a place of worship. A minister in a place of worship may not be compelled by any means, including the enforcement of a contract of property or any other legal requirements, to conduct a relevant marriage, be present at or carry out or otherwise participate in a relevant marriage, or consent to a relevant marriage being conducted, where the reason for the minister not doing so is that the relevant marriage concerns a same-sex couple. And two, a religious organization may not be compelled by any means to allow the use of premises owned or controlled by it for the purposes of a relevant marriage, where the reason for not doing so is that the relevant marriage concerns a same-sex couple. By not compelling ministers to carry out a relevant marriage of a same-sex couple in a place of worship, the above amendment imposes no obligation on ministers and protects those who do not wish to conduct, be present, carry out, or otherwise participate or consent to a relevant marriage. The section makes it clear that attempts to use the enforcement of a contract, statute, or other legal requirements to compel a minister to carry out a relevant marriage shall not be upheld. It respects and protects religious freedom. To this extent, government has not changed the definition of marriage as determined by any religion. The definition of holy matrimony, a sacrament of the Catholic Church, or the respective rights of marriage in the Jewish, Islamic, or Hindu religions remain entirely unaffected. Furthermore, any religious organization is also protected in that it may not be compelled to allow the use of any premises owned or controlled by them for the purposes of a relevant marriage of same-sex couples. Section 16, Mr. Speaker, provides a provision to opt out, and this to opt out by the marriage by a deputy registrar. And this section grants a deputy registrar who does not wish to conduct a relevant marriage of a same-sex couple a provision to opt out. This grant is akin to a position taken in relation to ministers under section 6A, insofar as a deputy registrar may not be compelled by any means to conduct a relevant marriage of the same-sex couple. In such cases, an alternative deputy registrar shall be assigned for the purposes of the relevant marriage. Again, this protects and respects religious freedoms of a deputy registrar, and at the same time allows for marriage of same-sex couples to take effect by appointment and alternate in history. Section 48, the Speaker, allows for the conversion of civil partnership into marriage of those couples who may wish to do so. The only requirement is that they must have formed a civil partnership pursuant to the Civil Partnership Act 2014. This section provides a power for the Minister with responsibility for personal safety to make rules establishing the procedure for conversion of civil partnerships, and such rules shall make provision for the technical arrangements with the Speaker. If a couple decides to convert their civil partnership into a marriage, once the conversion process is completed, the civil partnership automatically ends and the couple are treated as having been married since the date the civil partnership was entered into. There are also amendments to the Matrimonial Causes Act, Mr. Speaker. The Matrimonial Causes Act governs matrimonial causes and makes provision for matters incidental where two are connected therewith. Consequently, amendments are required to the Matrimonial Causes Act following the changes made to the Marriage Act for the purposes of this bill. The most important of the consequential amendments to the Matrimonial Causes Act is that marriage shall not be void on the ground that the parties are not respectively male and female under Section 25(1)(c), and that a marriage shall not be voidable under Section 25(a)(a)(b) when it applies to the marriage of a same-sex couple. The bill, Mr. Speaker, also allows government to amend any act of the city legislation by way of regulations in order to make further provision and such consequential, conditional, and saving provisions to emergency for the marriage of same sex couples. Mr. Speaker, I wish to single out the Linda Mazdusan and Nadia Cicalena Baeri from the government's Lord Justin Office for their hard work in this process in such a short period of time and also for their invaluable advice on the subject. A bill such as this one requires a lot of work as it has wide-reaching consequential amendments to many other pieces of legislation. Finally, Mr. Speaker, this bill will place all couples on the same footing as other couples already married at the registry office, as the proposed amendments to the Marriage Act will provide the same option for all. This, Mr. Speaker, is another historic step and a reflection of a progressive and inclusive society and a further testament of our commitment to equality. There is no such thing as gay marriage, Mr. Speaker. It will just be marriage for all. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The Honourable Elliot Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, today we are debating the amendment to the Marriage Act to bring about marriage between same-sex couples. I welcome the speech of the Honourable Member for Equality and commend the government in the manner in which it has brought the bill. Mr. Speaker, I will support the bill, subject to one reservation, because it provides this House the chance to support couples, loving couples of the same sex, who desire to be married. It is my hope that everyone in this House will support the government bill, because it will give the opportunity to those in our community to have their relationships celebrated, valued, and recognised by the state in the same way as everyone else's. Mr. Speaker, for those people inside and outside of this place who oppose the bill and argue that those couples already have a statutory framework for civil partnership, I say this. The introduction to the partnership was a step in the right direction, in my view, and I am proud that this House passed the legislation when it did. However, we need to take the next evolutionary step forward. I understand that there are those that strongly oppose the bill, and I respect their right to hold those views, but I do not agree with them. Mr. Speaker, this is not just about the ceremony of marriage and everything else that it entails. It is about the promotion and recognition of long and stable relationships. Why would we as a society want to prevent a same-sex couple from getting married just because they are gay? Marriage represents a meaningful commitment, and why should that not include those of the same sex? If we as a parliament fail to pass the bill, Mr. Speaker, we are saying to those who fall in love with someone else of the same sex that they are worth less than opposite sex couples. Mr. Speaker, there are a number of key objections to the amendments to the Marriage Act, and I feel duty bound to ventilate those objections so that this House can properly reflect on them, even though I form the view that these objections do not hold up to detailed scrutiny. Mr. Speaker, those who oppose the bill fear that religious organisations in our society which oppose same-sex marriage will be expected to perform marriage between gay men and women. This argument is, with the greatest of respect, wrong and misconceived. The amendment provides safeguards in the form of Section 6A of the bill that the Honourable Member talked about. Mr. Speaker, everyone in this House, I believe, respects the views of our religious leaders, and the safeguards provided in the bill demonstrate that we as a community recognise the right of our religious institutions to refuse to solemnise single-sex or same-sex marriages which do not accord with their belief system. Marriage, in my view, is not the preserve of religious organisations, and whilst respecting their religious freedom and their right not to conduct religious marriages between same-sex couples, we cannot and must not allow the exemptions or opt-outs contained in Section 16 to extend to registrars who conduct civil marriages on behalf of the state. I want to pause at that point and explain my reservation about Section 16. In my view, those charged by the state for conducting civil marriages cannot simply refuse to perform their public duties because of their beliefs. The marriage registrar and the deputy registrar are public officials, and as such, they must conduct marriages that are committed by our laws. On the superficial level, Section 60 provides for a mechanism whereby in a specific case of a deputy registrar refusing to conduct a marriage on the basis of its same-sex marriage can appoint a replacement registrar or an alternate, as the Honourable Member discussed before. In my view, and although we have created the architecture which purports not to offend basic fundamental rights, I believe that it is the wrong starting point to take. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, I have heard it being said that those who oppose same-sex marriage, that the word marriage by definition means marriage between a man and a woman, and that definition has been in place for hundreds if not thousands of years. The religious view is that marriage is between a man and a woman, and therefore the amendment to the Marriage Act compromises their faith. I have said that the bill protects their faith, but in my view it should not prevent this house from changing the law. Not amending the law simply reflects discrimination, plain and simple. The law, until relatively recently, provided that legal sex was between a man and a woman. For many years, women in marriage were treated by their husbands as property, in which fathers handed their daughters to a suitor and denied rights of their own. Years ago, the rape of a husband of his wife was not even illegal. In common law countries, civil marriage was introduced over 170 years ago, and at the time, I understand it was a radical move. In summary, Mr. Speaker, marriage has evolved over time, and why should it not evolve further? Thirdly, Mr. Speaker, I've heard it in advance that marriage is about the procreation of children, and I think this is a mischaracterization. Civil marriage does not, for instance, by definition, include reference to the bringing up into the world of children. Society does not prohibit the marriage of loving couples based on their ability to have children. There are many couples who cannot have children. Couples who marry after childbearing years. I accept that the process of marriage is the first step to the starting of a family in the significant majority of marriages. However, gay couples bring up children too. The lifelong commitment of marriage is much more than the bringing up of children. And at this point, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to Mr. Speaker's leave. I make reference to a former Shadow Home Affairs Minister who said this in the Westminster Parliament, which I thought was important to air here. And she said, "Most MPs will know the sadness, but also the inspiration that they have drawn from visiting a long married couple, where, for example, the wife is struggling to cope, struggling to remember the world around her, and struggling even to recognize her husband with whom she shared decades of her life. Yet she carries on, cooking for her, walking for her, getting her up, putting her to bed, talking to her as if she became a stranger in front of him. That is marriage. But I have also visited a gay man who died 3 years ago after a long illness, during which he was cared for every day at home, in hospital, and eventually in a hospice by his long-term partner. I do not see why that cannot be marriage too. The idea that the biology of procreation should deny same-sex couples the respect that comes with marriage is to ignore the full richness, the happiness, but also the tragedies of modern family life. For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, that, Mr. Speaker, is marriage. Fourth, it is argued that the same-sex marriage will undermine the institution of marriage. I disagree fundamentally with that proposition. Marriage has evolved over many generations. Britain, Spain, France, Denmark, Belgium, and others celebrate same-sex marriage, and their institutions have not collapsed. Our views in our community on homosexuality have changed and evolved over time, and we must now accept that. We must, as a Parliament, embrace this evolution and support the bill. The bill before the House is about giving couples who wish to marry the same rights as anyone else. The bill also protects the religious organisations who do not agree with same-sex marriage. I am of the view that the bill does not dilute the meaning of marriage, but rather evolves and strengthens the institution of marriage and the promotion of long and stable relationships, which can only be a benefit to our society. I have expressed my reservations about Section 60, but I cannot, in all conscience, vote down the bill that represents a fundamental step in the right direction. I commend the bill to the House.
Honourable Madam Hussain.
Mr. Speaker, in 1969, when Frankfurt infamously closed our frontier zone, some of the worst affected in our community were those whose partners lived on the other side. The pain suffered by all Gibraltarians was felt hundredfold by these individuals, and joyous relationships were suddenly strained with distance, separation, and needless uncertainty. Theirs is a mostly untold story of mournful heartache and wasted years that time could not fully repair. Thankfully, those times are now long behind us, but it is immensely saddening that so many years later, where progress has been made in other areas, there are still legal barriers hindering the affairs of the heart. The heart, Mr. Speaker, knows nothing about frontiers. It also knows not about gender. It knows not about doctrine. It knows not about what society expects. It knows only about love. This love is blind, but it is a powerful force that motivates many of our actions and pushes us to overcome the obstacles that are placed in our way. Indeed, while its course never runs smoothly, it can never understand why those obstacles are there in the first place and can never forgive those who put them there. This bill is not just about rights, Mr. Speaker. It is also about doing what's right. And what is not right is that we continue to allow the law to hang an anachronism over members of our community. Like love, the law must also be blind, and a law that claims to be secular must be allowed to neither discriminate nor privilege. It must not pass judgment on a love that has no impact whatsoever on the lives of others, and no longer must it impede the pursuit of happiness. To prevent two people who love each other from living their lives and realizing their dreams, that is the true abomination, and I commend the motivating principle behind this bill in writing a grievous wrong. However, Mr. Speaker, while I endorse this principle, I have to express serious reservations as the bill grants concessions to government workers to refuse to discharge their professional responsibilities. I am saddened that a bill that aims to end discrimination with one hand legitimizes it with the other. I am worried about the precedent this sets, as well as the seeming recognition that some members of our community are entitled to less than others simply because of their sexual orientation. This attitude would not be accepted toward any other minority, so it is disappointing to see it applied to our gay community, with a religious objection being permitted to override a professional duty and blunting the purpose of this bill. As a result, I am sorry to say that we fall short of legislating in favor of the inclusive and progressive society we all desire to live in. And it is in this spirit of addressing this that I will be tabling an amendment to clause 2.4 of the bill, which I shall present at committee stage. Thank you.
Is there any other contributor to the second, to the debate on the second amendment? The Honourable Dr. Joseph Bacon.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I do welcome the opportunity to say a few words on the government bill before the House today. Before doing so, I wish to congratulate my honourable friend, the Minister for Equality, Samantha Sacramento, for her leadership for the initiative and for introducing the bill. I say this because the proposed legislation before us has potentially created more controversy outside this Parliament than it has created inside this chamber. This is in itself a rare occurrence. Indeed, in 17 years in this House, it seems to me that this has been one of the most commented, talked about, and written about draft laws that we have debated. Controversy, Mr. Speaker, is not a bad thing. It serves to generate interest in the proceedings of the House and in the work that we do here on behalf of the people who elect them. It also exposes members to a whole range of detailed and strongly held views on both sides of the divide. My own view is that this bill is precisely about equality. It has used to ensure that the same avenues and procedures are available for mixed-gender couples are also made available to same-sex couples as well. That is the bottom line. Equality between citizens is the first duty of the state. Mr. Speaker, In 1999, the then administration, with our support, set up a select committee of this House in order to consider a reform of the 1969 Constitution. I was one of the five members of that committee. My colleague, Robert Sano, is the only member who is still in this House. The process involved in looking at the then Constitution line by line and making amendments to the text as it then existed. I recall that in the very first meeting of that committee, in December 1999, the human rights section was discussed, and in particular, the non-discrimination category that it contained. This is now Section 14 of the Constitution, which prohibits discrimination on a number of grounds. This lists the list of categories include sex, race, language, creed, and political opinion, among others. In that very first meeting, both Robert Sano and I flagged the possible inclusion of sexual orientation as one of those non-discrimination categories. Mr. Speaker, this happened at a time when the GDR, now the ERG, did not even exist, and when there was no external pressure in this regard. I remember the view from the then government members was that the same sex covered sexual orientation, and that therefore it was not necessary to include the specific reference as one of the categories on the list. Mr. Speaker, I say that because I am therefore proud to sit here as a member of the progressive team that has shown itself willing to consult, to listen, to discuss, and take a view on the issue. Many times in life, and also in politics, the easy option is to do nothing or to follow the line of least resistance. That is not the way we operate. When we take a view, we lead from the front. The House knows that a command paper was published in December 2015, and the views were taken until the end of January 2016. In March, an interministerial committee was established, and meetings were held with interested parties. I was not involved in that closely, but I know that it was intensive and meticulous. 3,490 responses to the consultation were made. This was the highest ever for any consultation on any proposed legislation. There have been voices accusing the government to have moved too slowly. The reality, Mr. Speaker, is that the more consultation there is, the slower that the process becomes. Indeed, at the other end of the spectrum, the government has also been accused of moving too fast. The fact is that this government has introduced civil partnerships in 2014 and is set to legislate on civil marriage only 2 years later. Mr. Speaker, the Civil Partnership Act was a landmark piece of legislation. It provided for the first time in Georgia for recognition by the state of a union between two people of the same sex. That recognition was also extended to opposite sex couples who did not want to get married. In a practical sense, this meant that the rights, the benefits, and the entitlements of citizens, which were enjoyed by heterosexual married couples, have now come to be enjoyed by same-sex couples as well. However, a couple made up of a man and a woman is also able to take advantage of civil marriage in order to have the union recognized by the state. This means that there are two routes for recognition by the state of unions made up of two people of opposite sexes. They can either enter into a civil partnership, or they can enter into civil marriage. Whereas same-sex couples only have one route for this recognition by the state, and that is the route of civil partnership. This is why, in my view, this is one of the qualities of citizens in the eyes of the state. The inequality lies not in the rights, benefits, or entitlements that are the route to bestow on the couple. It lies in the availability of one or two avenues to get them, depending on the sexual orientation of the people involved. Mr. Speaker, the discussions and debates that we have had in the world over this matter are no different to those that have arisen in other parts of Europe. As of June 2016, 13 European countries legally recognize and perform same-sex marriages. These are Belgium, Denmark, Finland, France, Iceland, Ireland, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. On the 22nd of December 2015, Jersey approved the principle that same-sex couples be allowed to marry. The relevant legislation is due to come into force in January 2017. In Guernsey, a year later, almost to the day, on the 21st of September of this year, the state of Guernsey approved the bill to legalize same-sex marriage by a vote of 33-5. It is true to say that there are also many countries that do not recognize civil partnerships or civil marriage between two persons of the same sex. Mr. Speaker, there is no right and wrong in this debate. The government has gone to great lengths to explain that this bill will have no impact on the different religions from the way in which they choose to define marriage or choose to practice their beliefs. Indeed, the reverse is true. The freedom of the religious denominations to continue as they always have done is explicitly reflected in the bill, following the representation that have been received. The bill, in my view, is not about religion at all. It is not about religious marriage. It is about civil marriage. At the heart of the bill is a close principle that every citizen should be equal in the eyes of the state. The central issue is that the different procedures and processes offered by the state for recognition of a union between two people should be open to everyone. There are two such processes, as I said earlier. These are civil partnership and civil marriage. Therefore, in the same way that civil partnership is open to all couples, regardless of their sexual orientation, civil marriage cannot be open to the heterosexual couples alone. That is not equality. The speaker will be supporting the bill.
The Honourable Neil Costa.
Mr. Speaker, well, it will not surprise anyone inside and outside of this House to hear me say that the government should have legislated to enable civil marriages for same-sex couples from the outset. There is no doubt in my mind that civil partnerships were a hugely important and progressive step forward. I'm extremely proud to have been a member of the government that introduced civil partnerships in 2014. And although civil partnerships provide legal recognition for same-sex relationships, it is absolutely right to now take the additional step for equality by introducing equal marriage into water and allowing same-sex couples the chance to marry if they choose to do so. To those who argue that civil partnerships contain, in all material respects, similar rights to marriage and that therefore this bill is in effect unnecessary, I would say that the legal partnership cannot logically be the same as civil marriage, because if it were, why have two legal schemes regulating unions? In other words, Mr. Speaker, by having a regime that enables same-sex couples to register their partnership, but another legal system to which they are not allowed to enter, we necessarily, as a society, are making a conscious distinction against same-sex couples. There is no skirting around the issue that we are saying that a civil partnership is not quite the same as a civil marriage. We are saying that same-sex couples are prohibited from entering into civil marriages, while opposite-sex couples may also enter into a civil partnership. In my view, plain discrimination. Mr. Speaker, imagine our collective disgust and dismay as our community if we substituted the same-sex couple for black couples, for Jewish couples, for couples with disabilities. We would rightly call it racism, anti-Semitism, and bigotry. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, this distinction that still exists today is clearly one that some in our society seek to maintain precisely because it is an important difference in the minds of some members of our community. Otherwise, one seeks and fights to keep this legal distinction. It is clearly the case. In the light of this wonderful debate, Mr. Speaker, we can enjoy into water without fear or prejudice that society views marriage and civil partnership as being different. Same-sex couples, therefore, rightly, in my view, feel the relationship is not valued by society in the same way as civil marriage. All couples who enter into a lifelong commitment should be able to call it marriage. If same-sex couples wish to exchange promises of love, of responsibility, of commitment to marriage, who am I, Mr. Speaker, to stop them? If a same-sex couple wishes to bring up children in love, in affection, in protection, and in family, why would I seek to prevent such a beautiful and meaningful thing to come to pass? Mr. Speaker, there is significant evidence that shows that opposite-sex couples do not have, to put it mildly, the best track record in bringing up children, and the only one. And one only has to read the newspaper to hear of some terrible tragedies that afflict vulnerable children. On the other hand, I am not aware of any studies that indicate that children raised in same-sex relationships fare any worse or suffer any more harm than a child who is brought up by same-sex couples. And, Mr. Speaker, if the House would allow me to be personal for just a moment, as a child of parents who separated at around 10, when I was around 10, I can tell the fact that I had no hesitation that it would not have made the slightest drop of difference to me if my parents were of the same sex and had they not gone through the suffering of their separation. I say, Mr. Speaker, who are we in Parliament, in governments, in the state, to tell any person whom they can love and how they can live their lives? I abhor such a thought and cannot countenance any action that may create laws that patently say that someone is slightly less than somebody else. Imagine, Mr. Speaker, the child at school who feels marginalized, different, perhaps inferior from his classmates because he is attracted to a member of his own sex. Imagine if you were the father who not fight, Mr. Speaker, for his child's right to enter into a civil marriage and to ensure that his child is treated in all respects exactly like everybody else. Mr. Speaker, in my opinion, we either believe that we are all equally worthy of the law's protection, or we do not. And it does beg the question, are we not all flesh and blood? Are we not all sentient human beings, wishing all of us in our way to be happy? Of course we are, Mr. Speaker, and I sincerely believe that we are all deserving of the same rights, privileges, and legal protection. And it would be, for me, Mr. Speaker, a frightening dereliction of my responsibility not to support this bill, because society considers our laws rightly as representing our values, and our values surely must be that we all love each other and that we are all equal as human beings. Mr. Speaker, I do of course recognise that members of our community worry about the way that our world is changing. There are those who argue that the definition of marriage has for hundreds, indeed for millennia, been between a man and a woman and has remained so. Others oppose same-sex unions because they believe that marriage is about the procreation of children. For some community members, it is their faith that matters, and therefore argue that it will weaken the institution of religious marriage. Marriage, Mr. Speaker, is that in fact allowing more couples to enter into marriage will actually strengthen the institution of civil marriage, not weaken it. There are countries in Europe, as the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister has said, who have introduced same-sex marriage, and it is not showing a weakness or an undermining of religious marriage in those countries. These countries have managed to introduce same-sex marriage while at the same time protecting religious freedom. And in that respect, Mr. Speaker, the bill before the House does protect the rights of those who do not agree with same-sex marriage. For those who are concerned that equal civil marriage threatens the freedom of religion, they can rest assured that the bill contains guarantees that neither a religious organisation nor a minister in a place of worship will be forced by law to marry same-sex couples. And, Mr. Speaker, I can assure religious members of our community, many of whom I have the great privilege of calling friends, that I will equally fight with the same ardour as I stand here today to fight for the cause of one civil marriage for all, for the right to freedom of worship, and not ever allow a situation where the state obliges a person of faith to act against their conscience. Let me also say, Mr. Speaker, that whereas I am no religious scholar, I have read the New Testament. And for me, what strikes me above all other things is the commandment to love each other and to love God. Mr. Speaker, I wish to thank the Honourable and Learned Lady, my own friend, Charles Bacalenta, who has shown, I think, great leadership in the South, in bringing forward the Civil Partnership Act and now the Civil Marriage for All. And I will urge her, in fact, to continue to be as progressive and, if I may, perhaps even more radical as the Parliament progresses. Mr. Speaker, I conclude by saying that equality is indivisible. One cannot be partially equal. Either one is equal or one is not. And therefore, the bill before the House tells the world that it values everybody equally in Gibraltar, and for this reason, I have no hesitation whatsoever to commend the bill to the House.
The Honourable Roy Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, I'm mindful of the Constitution. The first section of the Constitution deals precisely the protection of fundamental rights and freedoms. And Section 15 talks about the right to marry and found the family. And Section 15 reads quite simply, men and women of marriageable age have the right to marry and to found a family as prescribed by any law governing their spouse's rights. And I know to be silent as to who they may marry, except that they may marry. I personally identify with the comments of my honourable colleagues in the House so far this morning. I believe it is a measure that is perhaps long overdue. And if I may paraphrase the famous silent speech in the Open of Venice, have a gay couple not I, have a gay couple harm all these dimensions, senses, affections, and passions, study the same food, taught with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as an heterosexual couple. If you take what do you not believe? I'm going to speak, I think, and I agree with my colleagues in the past, that it is about equality and not about discrimination. I must say, on the whole, I'm satisfied with the intention of the bill to eliminate what is an unjust discrimination. However, I would welcome clarification from the members opposite as to how, on the one hand, as my honourable lady has said, they grant or remove discrimination, and yet, on the other hand, seem to liberalise an objection to it. If you were to change a few words in paragraph 6b, you would find it extremely obnoxious if you were to allow this kind of exemption in any other form of legislation in divorce. So, Mr. Speaker, I would welcome a clarification of members opposite as to how, on the one hand, they feel that this eliminates discrimination, and yet, on the other hand, allows it. That, Mr. Speaker, is, I think, important, and I note that the honourable lady to my left is proposing to delete this clause. I welcome the views of the members opposite as to whether or not they consider that proposal. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Edwin Green.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wish to make a small contribution because I believe I'm really certain on this house that I am actually conducted the same year on marriage. So I can talk from a different perspective and so on. Yes, Mr. Speaker, it's a bill that obviously I feel relatively easy to support. A couple of minor things that have been heard now by my honourable colleagues here on this side. I must start by saying that I like the words the honourable lady as a mover of the bill said that marriage was a meaningful commitment between two people. I'm starting from that point, yeah? Irrespective of whether the two are male or the two are female or happen to be male and female, there should be total unity in everyone in supporting that marriage is a meaningful commitment. The small differences seem to be arising in that we all wish to protect the religious institutions and their laws, for example, we take the Roman Catholic Church, the canon laws, and so on. And I don't think anyone has any problem in supporting the principle that we have to respect the laws. However, having been on that side of the marriage ceremony where from my point of view, it was canon law that was dictating where the High Court or could not conduct that marriage. Yes? Because canon law is far more stricter than who can enter into a marriage house. And it was the state that was allowing people like myself, who at the time were ministers of religion, to actually conduct the marriage. Very different to, for example, a marriage ceremony that I attended in my days when I lived in Rome as a student, when my friends were getting married. And we had to go through two marriage ceremonies. We had to go and have a state wedding at a particular state building, and then we had to go and have a church wedding at the church of the city because the state was not recognizing the marriage, recognizing the religious minister as an authorized person or registered to conduct a civil marriage because the claim was that their laws were completely different. I know colleagues from this side of the house are rightly saying, we're not entirely 100% yet convinced, and we want to hear what the government has to say about, on the one hand, trying to protect those who want to opt out of what is actually saying, technology. But I just want to warn both sides of the house do we really want to end up in a situation where church marriages will not at the same time simultaneously be recognized as civil marriages? Does it mean that those getting married would have to necessarily go one way to the civil registry and have a marriage there, and then most couples, like my girlfriend, a couple of weeks' time, seem to get married on the weekend because it's easy to get to the thing, and then the church wedding is something different? All I can say is that the father and the bride, it does cost a lot of expenses, and you have the both things happening in the same day, believe me. It costs quite a bit of money to get married nowadays.
But Mr. Speaker, having said that, like I think members on both sides of the House, we have heard what constituents have to say, we have taken their views on board and so on.
And I have listened to everyone with equal respect and so on. Yet there's one young lady. In fact, I don't think it's quite way too late yet, because I believe it's still a fixed format. Same with these words, which is your reason, Speaker, I want to end my contribution today. This young beautiful lady said, heterosexual marriage is a tradition. However, may I remind you that human ritual sacrifice, public execution, and curing illnesses with spells and magic were all considered a tradition. Let us go back to the days where we could watch people being beheaded in a town square. Shall we? Without this speaker, I declare my intention to support this country.
The Honourable John Cortez.
Mr. Speaker, one of the essential points that have been made in this debate, particularly outside this House, is that a government governs for all the people and not just for those who hold a particular view, whether or not it is the view of the majority. Having said that, it is clear that one of the main arguments used against the bill outside this chamber is a religious one. As a Catholic who tries his best to practice his Christian faith, this is important to me, and I have given the matter a great deal of thought. There is nothing society today, Mr. Speaker, that differs from some of the teachings of my church and of other denominations, Christian or otherwise, some of which have also expressed a view on the subject. Divorce, marriage between divorcees, extramarital sex, even what we do with the ashes of our deceased loved ones are examples, and all are allowed by civil society. Some may argue that these undermine the fabric of society, but society continues nevertheless. And the relationship between church, all denominations, and state continues to be excellent. There will be those who are religious who choose not to divorce, or refuse to do so. It is their choice and their decision. You would question that now, and I have not heard that point emerge in the public debate surrounding this bill. Nor is it for me, nor for this Parliament, to pass judgment, judge not, on the way that couples face this tough situation, express their free will, another important tenet of the faith with which I grew up. I would argue that the same applies to civil marriage. Indeed, civil marriage between a man and a woman exists and has existed in divorce for decades and is not a church wedding, but a civil occasion which clearly in concept is identical to what this bill wishes to introduce. It does not impose a duty for same-sex couples to marry, nor force anyone who believes it to be wrong to do so. Nor will the lack of such provision prevent persons of the same sex who love each other from entering into a relationship. What it does is give a right to all persons, regardless of sexual orientation, to be treated equally in civil terms in the eyes of the law, not of the church. Only the church can determine who marries under the church. But civil marriage is not the sacrament of holy matrimony, nor the equivalent in other denominations, and so I see no conflict. Mr. Speaker, as a practicing Christian, with total respect for those who disagree, with love for all of my fellow citizens, and with a clean conscience, I will be supporting the bill.
Is there any other contributor?
because of what we do for obliging.
Mr. Speaker, I will be personally supporting this bill. I have a history of supporting these kinds of issues. I'm a fervent supporter and believer in equality. I have stood in this house, Mr. Speaker, in minority of four against everybody else, except for four colleagues, including myself, voting for issues of this nature, including, it has to be said, my honourable friend, Mr. Rogers. And I see no reason why I should change my mind, and indeed I'm a firm believer in this particular issue of domain. What I intend to do, Mr. Speaker, is outline the policy of the DOD in relation to this. I will then very briefly go through my reasons as to why I will be supporting this bill. I will then address the question of the amendment by the Honourable Lady. I'd also very briefly touch upon some further amendments that I believe that are necessary in order to deal with blatant inequalities that may arise from this bill that I'm not asking the government to do it in the context of this bill, but to bear it in mind that further amendments will be necessary in the context in particular of the immigration, asylum refugee act. And it's something that I've touched upon in this house in the past. Mr. Speaker, the policy of the DOD is that it will not impose either on its MPs or on its members any view on a matter of conscience. It is up to an individual DOD member, an individual member of Parliament, to make his or her own mind as to the way that he or she want to support or not support, or vote in favour or vote against these types of issues. I believe that it is right that on these types of issues that impact on matters of conscience and people feel very strongly about, that they should have the right to express their own views in favour or against these kinds of issues. And indeed, the Honourable Lady, described the Civil Partnership Act as the first landmark moment in these types of issues. I disagree with her. And indeed, the first landmark moment was in 1991, because these issues are issues that develop over time. And the first landmark moment was 1991, when the Honourable the Father of the House, as Chief Minister of this community, brought a bill to this House to decriminalise homosexuality. And on that occasion, the DOD too allowed a free vote, and no one on our side of the political equation at the time voted against the decriminalisation of homosexuality. The next major effort,
1991, I was the leader of the opposition. The DOD were not in opposition.
It was 1992. I beg your pardon, it was 1992, quite right, but it was the Peter Caruana, or Peter Caruana the then was, who was the leader of the opposition. In 1992, on the decriminalization of homosexuality, the DOD allowed a free vote, and indeed nobody opposed the decriminalization of homosexuality. The next major step was in 2010, when I brought to this House a private member's bill in order to equalise the age of consent and bring down the age of consent for homosexuals from 18, as it then was, to 16. And the context in which that arose, Mr. Speaker, was because at the time I was amending all the criminal legislation in Gibraltar in the Crimes Act, and I took a position supported by Mr. Reddick, supported by Mr. Montiel, and supported by Mr. Nettle, that we would not come to this House with a bill modernizing all our criminal legislation and leave what was to us a blatant inequality in our legislation, which we believe was unconstitutional and, in any event, infringed on our conscience because of that inequality. And the way that that was resolved within the government of the day was that I was supported in the bringing of a private member's motion
where that private member's motion was supported by four members of the GOP government at the time, and everybody in this House, including the then opposition, voted against. In 2010, as a consequence of that, the matter was then placed before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court then came back and agreed with a view expressed by myself, expressed by Mr. Regis, by Mr. Montiel, and by Mr. Nedger, that in fact the inequality was unconstitutional. And as a consequence of that, we then brought the Crimes Bill, which was supported by every single member of the DOD government at the time, which equalized the age of consent at 16. It is very right that the Honourable Lady then brought to this Parliament the Civil Partnership Act, which was and is rightly described as a landmark moment in the advancement of civil rights and in the advancement of these types of issues. And indeed, at the time, everybody on this side of the House also supported this particular bill, and everybody on this side of the House, despite the fact that it is a matter on which they're voting their consciences, and there is no four-line whip operating on this side of the House, everybody on this side of the House is going to be supporting this bill today. Because either from my own point of view, and the reason why I support it, not only because I support equality, and I have a track record of supporting equality, and I believe that equality has to be advanced at every single opportunity, and one of the reasons why I have made the point that I have made about the Honourable Lady's comment about the first landmark moment, is because society has to remain vigilant. Society has to remain vigilant, and we cannot see that bill or this bill as a final moment in the advancement of civil rights and in the advancement of equality. As society develops, there will be further, no doubt, landmark moments, and I hope to be in this House, Mr. Speaker, in order to support this. But, Mr. Speaker, more than anything else, I support this bill for this reason. I am a firm believer, Mr. Speaker, in the institution of marriage. My parents were also, like the parents of Mr. Foster, divorced when I was 10, in fact, in the same as Mr. Foster. But I believe that marriage offers a cementing and stable environment in which families are brought up, in which children, in my view, are brought up. And I believe that having allowed gay couples, as indeed the Honourable Gentleman, I left this out in the history of Long Night Moment, the Honourable Gentleman allowed for the case to be brought to court in relation to their adoption, which has now been allowed as a consequence of a decision of the Supreme Court, I think it was in 2013, which I believe it was also a Long Night Moment. But having taken the decision, by law or otherwise, that gay couples can adopt, I think it's wholly illogical to then say that gay couples cannot have access to that institution of marriage that has those benefits for those couples. In my view, it's completely and utterly illogical. If gay couples want to marry, or if straight couples want to marry, they should have the right to marry, and gay couples should have the right to marry. And I believe that the marriage provides that stable, cementing environment in which families are brought up, and therefore it should be accessible, in my view, to gay couples. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the amendment, Mr. Speaker, this is where I am in a minority on this side of the House. Mr. Speaker, I believe that the clause allowing an opt-out on religious grounds, for registrars, is justifiable, and I will be supporting that particular clause in the bill, and I will be voting against the amendment. Because is a very small community. It is a tolerant community. In Gibraltar, we have learned to live with each other, different religions, in a melting pot that is Gibraltar. Indeed, the Gibraltarian people have grown out of this melting pot. And the stability that we have in our society comes from tolerance. And I believe that if we are to be that tolerant society that has been so successful in living with each other and tolerating our different religious beliefs and our different beliefs in other spheres too, that we have to allow people who have a religious conviction and therefore stand up for religious conviction, perform a civil marriage, to have the opt out and for that not to be forced on them, Mr. Speaker. And let me also say this, that although I am a believer and a firm believer in equality, one of the things that I lament most in the way that the United Kingdom and other jurisdictions have developed as a consequence of some of the legislation that's been introduced from the equality perspective in some of those jurisdictions, have been the forcing on Christian minorities, on Muslim minorities, or religious minorities to do things that they would not otherwise have done because of their conscience. And let me give the House some examples of that. Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely ridiculous in my view, absolutely ridiculous, that a bakery in Ireland ought to be forced to bake a cake for a gay marriage and be found liable in a court of law for not doing so, simply because we're talking about Christian bakers, Catholic bakers, who took the view that on religious grounds they were not prepared to bake that cake. And there ought to be a sense of a sensibleness in my respectful view in relation to this. And we should not be forcing people to do things that go against their religious convictions. In the United Kingdom, one of the largest adoption organizations in the United Kingdom was the Catholic Church. One of the largest adoption centers, and indeed other Christian churches. As a consequence of some of the equality legislation that was introduced in the United Kingdom, it has forced these adoption centers to close, who were placing children in worthwhile families. They had to close because their own religious convictions would not allow them to obviously adopt the gay couple. Now, I may disagree with that. And I may say, a gay couple is just as capable of adopting and bringing up a child in the context of a loving, safe, and secure relationship as anybody else. But I think that we have to be sensible in society. And that we've got to recognize that there are people with different views, that there are people like those Christian organizations in the United Kingdom that offer a worthwhile service to society, and we should not be forcing those people to do things that go against their own conscience. And I think it is right in that context for the government to introduce into this bill a clause that will allow registrars to opt out of gay marriage, civil marriage, on religious grounds. And for those reasons, Mr. Speaker, I will be opposing the amendment that is proposed by my honourable lady friend, Marlene Nahon, and her son. And finally, Mr. Speaker, in relation to a further amendment, I would also invite the government to bear in mind that not only does the Matrimonial Causes Act need to be amended, but also the Immigration, Asylum and Refugee Act. And I brought this matter to the House in the past, but I think it is an important matter. At the moment, what we have is a blatant discrimination against men who are
are married again, are married to foreign women who cannot, who their wives are not entitled to the same residency rights as a situation where a Gibraltarian woman is married to a foreign man, or indeed, Mr. Speaker, because they amended this particular act upon the introduction of the Field Partnership Act, or indeed a gay couple that has entered into a civil partnership. And I think that that is wrong. It is a gross discrimination against the children of a Gibraltarian man married to a foreign woman, which again are discriminated against in relation to those in a civil partnership, and also gay people in a civil partnership, and also a Gibraltarian woman married to a foreign man. And I think that in the context of that act that is now going to have to be amended, of course, in order to also recognise that there is a civil partnership, that we should end that discrimination across the board, and I invite the government to do so. But for those reasons, Mr. Speaker, I will be supporting this bill, and I will also be voting against the amendment proposed by the Honourable Lady.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I do think today is a landmark day for this community and for the Parliament. And I want to start with Section 15 of the Constitution, which the Honourable Member referred, which is the section that relates to the right to marry and found a family. Mr. Speaker, that section, what it means, what it has been interpreted to mean in the case law, the European Convention, the European Court of Human Rights, and what it says on the face of it, in my view, is central to a determination of how this Parliament deals with this matter. And I know it's been central also to the course of the debate in the community, because many have said that there is no right to marry in the course of contributions that I've read in the past year. But in fact, Mr. Speaker, Section 15 of the Constitution, our principal and overriding enactment, actually says this: men and women of marriageable age have the right to marry and to found a family as prescribed by any law governing the exercise of this right. So it is a right, and that right is exercised in keeping with laws and this Parliament makes laws. But anyone who has approached this debate from the point of view that there is no right to marry has failed to read Section 15 of the Constitution, or at least has failed to understand it, because I've also read some comments to suggest, well, it's a right for men and women. Well, Mr. Speaker, we may describe our sexual orientation in different ways. I've learned from Samantha Sacramento that it's now LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, and transgender, LGBTC. But we don't describe each other physically as anything other than men and women. So this is a right that applies to everyone in our community, regardless of their sexual orientation, and that is already preserved in our Constitution. And it doesn't say, Mr. Speaker, in this section, that this is a right for men and women to marry each other. That would have been an important addition to this section, if that is what was meant by it. Men and women of marriageable age have the right to marry, full stop. And then goes on to talk about finding a family. Well, Mr. Speaker, therefore, I think that it is essential that this clause of our Constitution is central in our minds as we have the debate that we are having today. Mr. Speaker, I did not imagine on the 9th of December 2011 that I would be speaking of Gibraltar. to see a bill move for equal marriage, whilst I was in the government that I was leaving, I did not imagine that that would be the case in 2011 when we were framing our manifesto, when we had the internal debate of what we would do to deal with this issue of discrimination, that same-sex couples were not able to enter into a partnership. I sincerely believe that we were not just trailblazing, we were doing the right thing in the right way when we brought the legislation on civil partnership. We did it, Mr. Speaker, in a way that has not been done, for example, in the United Kingdom, where civil partnerships were available only to couples who were of the same sexual orientation, but not to heterosexual couples, creating thereby a new discrimination, which has just been undone in the UK, but which we were careful not to create in Gibraltar when we made our civil partnerships Mr. Speaker, I told the House in March 2012, in answer to question 318 of 2012, that I believe we have satisfied the concerns of the LGBT community in the creation of the civil partnership. In fact, I specifically said this, Mr. Speaker, and it's not good to go around quoting oneself, Mr. Speaker. And Lord Denning used to do it by laying down a bit of law that he would come back to quote of himself in order to lay down new bits of law. But I think it's important that when we said things and we changed our minds, that we say up to it and understand why that is happening. I said specifically this. My own view is that we should not have gay marriage in Gibraltar, but we should have civil partnerships. That was in March 2012. Mr. Speaker, for me, it has been a road of long consideration and a very careful thought, which I can only describe as very deep soul searching, come to the conclusion that in the context of the following general election, the one in 2015, the position of the party that I lead and of the executive of one of the parties in the alliance of this government should be to propose a consultation in the context of our manifesto to do exactly the opposite of what I believe in 2012 did not happen. But people, what was it that changed my mind in that respect? Well, the dates here are actually very, very important, but most of my thinking is actually developing in discussions and considerations of this issue with my own wife. You think, Mr. Speaker, in March 2012, I was the husband of a very pregnant wife, but I was not a father. I became a father in April of 2012. And Mr. Speaker, I don't think there is anything that changes your outlook like having a child and understanding the importance of what that child means to you and how that child looks to you for protection in his early life. And Speaker, you see, my discussions at home have been very, very concerning from the point of view of where I was in March 2012. Because you figure, put yourself in the position of a husband who has asked this. Now that you have a little boy, how would you feel in 30 years' time if your son has that sexual orientation and he is not able to do something that everybody else who is of a different sexual orientation is able to do? In terms of the civic, not in terms of the physical or in terms of something else, in terms of the civic. And if he were able to turn around to you then, in 30 years' time, and say, I can't marry Dad, because when you have the power, you didn't control it. But if you think that this is not a place of power exercised in that way, this is not a place where I am going to say to the 10 people who sit on my side, none of whom are in Gibraltar today, you must vote in one particular way or you must not vote in a particular way. But it's not the way to exercise power, but to search your soul, to understand what you may have done that led you to a conclusion that may have been wrong, and to then seek to understand with your community whether you should make those changes that might lead to a different conversation 30 years, then I think it's the right thing to do. And that's why we included in our manifesto, after a long discussion in our executive committee where there were different views, after a detailed discussion with our colleagues and partners in the Liberal Party, that we would do a consultation in the whole of our community. So, Mr. Speaker, I'm not in bad company in changing my mind on this subject. President Obama was against equal marriage in 2008. He said that he believed that the United States should pursue civil unions and not civil marriages for those of the same sex. And yet, by 2013, in his second inaugural address, he said this: if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. And in 2015, I think the whole world will remember the words which resonated from him when he welcomed the decision of the United States Supreme Court to make equal marriage legal in the United States through a judicial decision, not through a legislative change. So, Mr. Speaker, our approach has been to go to the community with this system. Our manifesto, Mr. Speaker, our strongest foundation manifesto of 2015, has pages 95 and 96 deals with the issue of equality. It sets out the work we have done by November last year and the work that we are seeking a mandate to continue to do. And in a section which is in great measure down to the drafting of the Honourable Lady and the discussion, the detailed policy discussions of the Executive Commission, it says this on page 96, civil partnership. We trailblazed with the landmark commitment, which we have already delivered, to introduce into law the Civil Partnership Act. This recognizes the right of people to have their same-sex relationships reflected in legislation, and all rights to the proof in this, because we should not consider it was right for the state to discriminate between people on the grounds of their sexual orientation. This regime is now also open to opposite sex couples so that there is full equality across all the sexual orientations. We will now publish a command paper in order to take the views of the public on how best to deal with the request by some for civil marriage to be extended to same-sex couples. We are totally committed both to ensuring that religious denominations are not forced to change their practices, beliefs, or sacraments in any way, and to the principle that the state must not discriminate between individuals based on grounds of sexual orientation. The results of the responses to the command paper will be published by June next year. This manifesto garnered wholesale support during the course of the last general election in Gibraltar, and that commitment was part of the manifesto before the people at the general election. In fact, I am very pleased that we introduced also the concept of the command paper, because the command paper was not known to this Parliament and to our laws until 2011, when we became the government. We were therefore able to put in the context of that command paper, which is a paper published by command of Her Majesty through the government, and I'll come to that later, because this is a government bill, an important issue to highlight, which both the Honourable Lady and the Deputy Chief Minister. But this is a command paper published by command of Her Majesty for people to consider what their views are and to come back with the music that was expressed in the context of that consultation. So, Mr. Speaker, I think we were able to publish the command paper in time, and I think we have slipped by about 60 days in the context of publishing the responses to that, because we were permitted to a date in June this year, but a small matter of a referendum dealing with some international partnerships with the United Kingdom has really dominated the first half of this year. But we otherwise complied with our undertaking up to the letter. Before I move on to deal with that part of what we did, Mr. Speaker, dealing with civil marriages, I want to just reflect for a moment on civil partnerships. Because in the same way as civil partnerships in the United Kingdom excluded effective sectors, and we did not, and they had to change this, it is also true, Mr. Speaker, that civil partnerships have found a life beyond their original raison d'etre. I mean, the original reason for civil partnerships was to provide a route for people of the same sex to have the ability to enter into stable relationships recognized by the state without knocking on the door of marriage. But of course, as we allowed them here, obviously, heterosexual couples also, and they were allowed eventually in the UK also for heterosexual couples, civil partnerships have found a different sort of life for themselves. And this very morning, Mr. Speaker, perhaps providentially, and in time for my speech, I read in one of my favorite columns in the Times, the Matthew Paris This Week column, the following excellent reference. And Matthew Paris writes this of himself, the title is Not the Marrying Kind. He says, Mr. Speaker, that new data offers an interesting peek into gay relationships. The number of civil partnerships formed last year is almost half the number in 2014, when gay marriage was introduced. So far, still unsurprising. If marriage is available, less people are likely to be gay, or the civil partnerships is introduced to avoid those marriages. But within that figure, he says, this is a more striking one. Nearly half of new civil partnerships are between over 50, compared with only a fifth in 2013, the year before marriage became an option. And his conclusion, Mr. Speaker, I think is as amusing as it is informative. That many older gays get hitched by still resisting marriage, the desperate opposition to the reform was not always rooted in moral disapproval, but sometimes in reluctance to change the meaning of long familiar words. Kind friends sometimes call my partner a mere husband. Though I've tried, I just can't get comfortable with that word. But then again, I'm 67. Well, Speaker, it may be that it's important to highlight that simply because the option is on the table, it doesn't mean that we're going to require anybody or force anybody else to do it. Mr. Speaker, the consultation which we undertook was probably the widest consultation exercise undertaken in this community, definitely in my political lifetime. I don't know whether something has gone deeper than the consultation on this command paper, but it's certainly not something I remember. The committee in the Constitution, with the leader of the House, the Honourable Father of the House, and the Deputy Chief Minister, have formed part of, opened itself out to contributions from the community. There were lots of people who were politically involved who wanted to contribute to that, but the depth and breadth of the support for this command paper in the responses to it is something I've never come across before in my political life. And if I may say so, Mr. Speaker, it rings across the board of the whole of the community. We engage with so many people, Mr. Speaker. People I've never met before, people I thought I knew and had views that I was not able to associate with, and of course, some who I knew who had views I knew I could associate with, Mr. Speaker. And if I may say so, with thanks, the representations made also included representations made very thoughtfully and carefully and sensitively by his lordship, the Bishop Dominic, and his lordship, the former Bishop Hester, and I'll come to some of those contributions in a moment. The first part that I want to come to, Mr. Speaker, is in the opinion that his lordship, the Bishop, provided on the 8th of September 2016, which is published in the Book of Proverbs, on the eve of his ordination in Malta, where he said that as bishop of many in the world, he was writing his letter to express concerns about the issue of Easter marriage and to share some consideration. And I thought there was a part of the house should be referred to, two parts in particular. The first is this. At paragraph 11, his lordship says this: whatever the decision of Parliament regarding this matter, the Church will hold fast to its authentic understanding of marriage, which has been written in the human heart, consolidated in history, and confirmed by the Word of God. Any civil law allowing same-sex marriage has no bearing on the teaching of the Church regarding the sacrament of marriage. That is absolutely right, Mr. Speaker. Whether one shares his lordship's view in respect of the first part of his sentence, or not, the second part of this paragraph is, of course, absolutely true. Nothing that we are doing here today in any way affects the teachings of the Church regarding the sacrament of marriage or any other religious teaching in relation to the many incarnations of marriage. And if the bishop, I think, said in some of his other public interventions, but he said directly to us in the interministerial committee meeting that we had with him and other members of the Church proposes but does not impose. And I think the Church has been, through his work in tradition, exquisite in observing that approach, in providing us with information, in providing us with guidance on what their views are, but has not for one moment suggested that we should or should not do any particular thing in the context of the consultation, and indeed is not purporting to say to the community that it must or must not do any particular thing. Those views of his lordship, Mr. Speaker, the views of every member in this House has expressed, and the views of everybody who contributed to the consultation, and those who didn't, all of them are protected and preserved by Section 9(1) of our Constitution, which says this: protecting the freedom of conscience, except with his own consent, no person shall be hindered in the enjoyment of his freedom of conscience, and for the purposes of this section, the said freedom includes freedom of thought and of religion, freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom, either alone or in community with others, and both in public and in private, to manifest and propagate his religion or belief in worship, teaching, practice, and observance. The first phrase of that paragraph is the most important, because it says, except with his own consent, no person shall be hindered in the enjoyment of his freedom of conscience. Everything else is mechanics. So, we live, Mr. Speaker, in a free society where one is free to worship or not worship the God of gods, God that one wishes to worship or not worship, and in a society which, in the other section I have read you, establishes the right of men and women to marry. And Speaker, it wasn't just his lordship and the Church that provided us with useful and careful and sensitive guidance on aspects of this proposed amendment. It was also the Evangelical Alliance, who represents a lot of other denominations and who spent a lot of time with us. Very convivial time, even though you might have different views, but a very convivial time understanding each other and understanding the issues that we were wrestling with and wanting to deal with in the best possible way for this community. And the Equality Rights Group, Mr. Speaker, who have led on this issue for those seeking marriage equality, with whom we have a very positive engagement, not just in respect of the protection of the fundamental rights of all those who wish to marry regardless of their sexual orientation, but also, if I may say so, the protection of people to practice their own religion in their own way, and how those rights must also be preserved, something which the Equality Rights Group were very keen to ensure we understood they were as signed up to as they might have been signed up to the cause of equal marriage.
We met, Mr. Speaker, with a group of lawyers, young and not so young, who, of course, you professors I knew well, and in fact, all members of the Ministerial Committee happened to be lawyers, so we all knew each other and have always got on relatively well, and had a good legal ding-dong on the subject of marriage and rights and not rights. And their thinking was also helpful in informing us in how we framed some of the objections that we had been asked to consider by the Church, and which some of these members of our professors in Hyderabad were able to help us take it in some way. We disagreed with most, Mr. Speaker, but not with all who came to see us in that context. Mr. Speaker, this was a process of consultation that resulted in the most careful consideration, most in-depth analysis of what was put to us in the context of this command paper and the responses to it. And if I may say so, Mr. Speaker, I think I speak for all of the members of the Interministerial Committee when I say that I think this was a hugely, hugely enriching process. This was not just dealing with the law, this was dealing with who we are in a values-based system like Gibraltar. Where is our morality today? Is this law a law that affects our morality in some way? It was a hugely stimulating and enriching process. I chaired that interministerial committee with Samantha Sacramento, Neil Costa, Gilbert Iguri, and Albert Isla as members of it. Albert Isla is, as members will know, in China today and in government business. Mr. Iguri and Mr. Costa are here. They will agree with me that Samantha Sacramento's work in relation to equality is absolutely trailblazing and landmark. In many ways, Mr. Speaker, attitude is probably the first way that marks her out for distinction in this field. Because you see, the matter of whether doesn't need to be told that laws need to be changed to provide for a more equal society. She feels it instinctively and understands it instinctively, and she's not in a position where she has to come with a private member's bill to this House, Mr. Speaker. She seeks to rely on opposition votes to change things. This is a woman who's able to count on government support because she persuades those who might need persuading them, but we know that it takes long to be persuaded. But when she raises an issue of equality, that it must be dealt with in that particular way. And she's a young talent, Mr. Speaker, who I think the equality, those advocates for equality outside of the Parliament, which you might call the equality lobby, have long recognized as a magnificent advocate for equality. She's the one, Mr. Speaker, who told me that it's not gay marriage. And we sometimes go around using the terms like gay marriage as shorthand in the context of this debate. It's not gay marriage. It's about equal marriage. And terminology matters. Political correctness is not something that people should have much time for, but the importance of terminology and how different terminology can hurt others is something that we should all have regard to, and we have consistently kept it on a straight and narrow in that respect, and we've fallen into shorthand. Mr. Speaker, if I can just deal briefly with the usual discordant note that the current leader of the opposition has struck in respect of the debate, which I feel I must reply to, especially given the fact that he's given us a draft of his retirement and resignation letter already during the course of a recent television programme, at the same time as he told us that he felt he wasn't paid enough for the job that he does. Putting those things to one side, Mr. Speaker, and ready to deal with them in the context of another debate. Look, we agree that in relation to the sexuality, the first landmark moment was the decriminalization of that by the first GSLP government in the course of its second administration, not its first administration. If I'm thinking of the speaker, when it comes to criminal laws, I don't think that Parliament for people to vote their consciences, although I always expect my party to vote with conscience. They don't need to be given a free vote to vote their consciences. I actually expect them to vote their consciences every time they come here. If they disagree with me, they disagree with me. I need them to vote my conscience, and so obey. That is what they are paid for, because they are members of Parliament. And that is part of the allowance that they paid, the one that the Honourable Gentleman took to the decision to vote too low, to come here and vote their consciences. But to have to be given a free vote on whether or not to decriminalize here, Mr. Speaker, it's really quite something. But the Honourable Gentleman is wrong about so much, Mr. Speaker, that even when he refers to facts which are so objectively determinable as to how people voted, he gets it wrong. Mr. Corby voted against. Well, he voted against the decriminalization then. My conscience does not allow me to vote in favor of the amendment. Mr. Speaker, that is quite something. That is quite something. It's really quite incredible that the Honourable Gentleman tries to use that as a badge of honour in the context of what his party stands for in terms of equality. Really quite something. And then he talks about his record of standing for this thing. So, Mr. Speaker, look, he came here with a private members bill on the age of consent, on equalizing the age of consent, where he wanted to rely on opposition votes to get it through. When exactly in the same way we were dealing with the issue of decriminalization in 1992, our view was that it was an absolute scandal that the equalization of the age of consent, which was a legal requirement, should come to this parliament by the hand of a Minister for Justice's private members' bill. It was absolutely disgraceful, Mr. Speaker. It should have come as a government bill, Mr. Speaker. Not as a private member. So look, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman wants to clothe himself in the cloak of being the most equal person here. But look, if it were true that he is, he would be fulsome and genuine in his support for the work that the Honourable Lady has done, and for the work that the Honourable, the former Minister for Health, Mr. Godfrey, has done. Because if there is one thing that we can be absolutely proud of, it's our record in respect of equality. The Honourable Gentleman has recently ensured that IVF is available for same-sex couples in the same way that it's available for heterosexual couples, something that we've introduced ourselves in many years, Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Lady's work in respect of equality does not need to be spelled out for people to understand how magnificent it has been. But, Mr. Speaker, to try and denigrate that in the context of this debate and to bring the partisan into it, I think really demonstrates that the Honourable Gentleman is really interested in putting on such cloak as he thinks might garner him some element of support at any particular time. And I think it's unfortunate that this otherwise convivial debate on which we have been able to hear contributions from members of the group, where I think we have all agreed that has to be tarnished by that attempt to bring in the partisan. And if he is such a champion of equality, Mr. Speaker, such a champion of equality, where was this in the country? Because, Mr. Speaker, let's be clear. We had a soul-searching debate in our executive. I had a soul-searching debate at home with my wife, thinking about the future of my children. We put it in our manifesto, and we acted in keeping with our manifesto. Where is it in here? We'll do the same thing in relation to smoking in public spaces. Another important issue of a different type. Honourable Member's manifesto in 2011 was six of one and half a dozen of another in respect of smoking in public places. You could sense in the manifesto this was a tightrope walking exercise of trying to appease those who were in favour of stopping smoking in public places and not annoy the smokers. And Speaker, for the Honourable Gentleman to now say that he is the champion of equality, and that he has a record of standing for these things, when he was the person responsible for the, pamphlet that was put out at the last election, which was silent on the subject, despite a letter from the Equality Rights Group dealing with the issue and asking parties to state their positions on it, is really to ask people to believe anything. I think the other gentleman was honest when he says that he thinks he's on the page. He has such a high opinion of himself. I do believe he thinks he's on the page. And I'm very grateful he went on television to say that he thinks he should be remunerated better than he is. But everything else, Mr. Speaker, just doesn't ring true. It doesn't ring true. Anyway, the champion of equality, he didn't put anything about equal marriage in his pamphlet. I think that is very little to the debate, but I do welcome the contribution from other members. If I may say so, though, he's not here to hear him in the speech of Mr. Hurley, so I think it was a very interesting and prominent contribution, because he has been a man of the cloth, as he reminded us. He has actually married people. And it is also important for us to recognize and appreciate the journey that he has made and the contribution that he has made today in this Parliament, and I sincerely, sincerely value it, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the consultation also included debates organized in other fora. I mean, the Panorama, the Chronicle carried contributions from one and another. The public broadcaster, the public broadcaster, organized a debate on the subject, which I think was held at one of the seminars. Joe Garcia contributed to that one, another one. Erica Lou, both of whom I think also contributed lengthy pieces in the local press on the subject of their objection to changes in the legislation. Eddie Wood, Charles Gomez, and Charles, I think, is one of the people who came to see us in the context of a later, more detailed consultation. And he's also written extensively in the local media and social media. I think he contributed from the floor in the context of that debate. And finally, Mr. Speaker, Ivan O'Mandy, who was on that viewpoint program and who wrote, for me, the most touching opinion on this subject. He wrote an absolutely excellent contribution that told us not just about why he thought the rules should change from an objective point of view, from the international point of view, from the rules and morals point of view. He talked to us about himself and the discrimination he had suffered, overtly and not overtly, because you see, sometimes it's people who think that simply because we don't call somebody an awful name, we're not discriminating against it. And I've heard it said before, well, in Gibraltar we've never discriminated against gays, we've never given them a problem. Well, we don't have to be Zimbabwe beating up people who love people of the same sex, or Russia who do the same thing, to discriminate against people and to make them feel excluded. And this man's opinion explained to us that he had not felt able to return to Gibraltar to live with his parents and his extended family, his brothers, etc., because of the way Gibraltar was structured in society. Sometimes the most learned, the most intelligent, understand the structures of state discrimination better, and therefore find them so anathema that they cannot form part of that state. And that is what Ivan told us in that piece. He said, I couldn't come back to be with my family, because the place in which I wish to live institutionalized a discrimination against what I was. And that was a subjective contribution that I think was amongst the most powerful things I have read in a long time in any newspaper, local, national, or international. And I thank him for having shared that level of his yearning for equality with the rest of the community.
it was not wasted at all. In particular, there were 2,336 contributions in the consultation. 2,336 contributions to a command paper is an extraordinary number. It is literally 10% of the electorate. 10% of the electorate. It's almost a fifth of our vote and almost half a vote. That is an extraordinary number. 1,368 comments were in favour, and the Commission may want to have these numbers. 1,368 comments were in favour, 955 comments were against same-sex marriage, and 13 were in favour of a referendum to decide the matter. Well, Mr. Speaker, every single person who wrote a contribution, or who simply signed the contribution with which they agreed, which had been prepared by others, deserves the thanks of the government for having become engaged in this process with us and for their respective contributions. If I may say so, Mr. Speaker, instead of each of us putting on a cloak of how we are a champion of this or of that, what we need to do, and what we need to reflect as representatives of our community, is how proud Gibraltar should be of itself, of the debate that we have had, of the way in which we have had it, of the amount of contributions filed, and frankly, Mr. Speaker, of the magnificent and peaceful way in which we don't just tolerate, but we respect each other's feelings, and we understand each other's feelings. Mr. Speaker, it is also absolutely true that the figurehead of this push for equal marriage has undoubtedly been Felix Calvados, who has really pushed for this change in the law along with others. But what was the person who was prepared to put his head above the parapet and in order to become unpopular in order to pursue an issue in which he believes, and it is right that he should recognize the work that he has done in addressing the issue. Usually with Charles Pittaker in tow, who comes to see us, and if I may share an infinite reference to speaker of one of the meetings that we had in the Interministerial Committee with Felix and with Charles, and when we were saying to them that I was sharing my views and the views of others, who said, I made my own views public, why I thought this could proceed. Charles Pittaker said to me, well, Felix and I, probably done the easy part, which is to persuade you. The difficult thing now is to find ourselves a husband. Well, I suggested that perhaps we should talk to each other, but Felix said, they both deserve to be singled out, Mr. Speaker, for a particular mention and for the thanks of this community for having led from the unpopular front, Mr. Speaker. The contributions that we've had have really been reflections of very deeply held beliefs and of the things that define each of us as individuals and therefore as a collective define us as a people and as a community. And I think this is really the best and deepest debate that we have had as a nation for many generations. I don't know how our laws and divorce came to be in our country. I don't know how our laws and other controversial areas came to be in our country, but in those days there was just consultation, there was no command paper, there might have been the British government putting pressure, and in some of the other overseas territories, the British government has put pressure simply not just to decriminalise homosexual activity, but to also get rid of the death penalty, which is still on the threshold for some of the other overseas territories. That may have come about in that way. This is a change in our law that we as a community are bringing ourselves after the deepest soul searching, because it's clear that people have really dug deep to understand who they were
what they wanted to say to us in the context of the contribution that they were making, where we come from, where we're going to, what is it that we feel our journey should be in the future, and how this law fits into that. But it may be that we don't have debates about morality and about equality often enough these days. The only way that we tell this that we must not take equality for granted, that's absolutely right. Perhaps we could be having more of these debates. Perhaps we have too many debates about finances and foreign policy, and we don't pause often enough to debate who we are and where we're going and how our laws should reflect that. I happen to think, Mr. Speaker, that one of the reasons that doesn't happen is because the big moral questions have been settled, because the left has won all of the arguments. Before, people were not entitled to universal education. They are now, because the left won the argument. People were not entitled to universal health care, because the left won the argument. Dare I say it, Mr. Speaker, there was no universal suffrage until the left won the argument. That might have been true if there wasn't, considering over the largest share of the voters just of landowners that they did with the general population. But those moral questions, Mr. Speaker, have been settled because the left won the argument. But the left must never forget that it's important to keep winning the argument. Mr. Speaker, we've also confronted this debate with maturity. And I don't think that not just my colleagues in government, but everybody that has settled us in the consultation for that maturity. And for the courage and the conviction that it takes to put yourself out there and to give of you that on one side or the other, you know, will be unpopular with the other side. It's also true, Mr. Speaker, that the debate has been found overwhelmingly in the spirit of respect, not the tolerance of respect and deep respect. And I think that was most in evidence at that viewpoint program that I referred to already. Some people have talked about their religion, some people have talked about their morality, some people have talked about their conscience, and some people have talked about themselves. But where we've done so, we've been able to do so largely, and I think with only two exceptions of our country, without causing each other any pain, without calling each other any names, or without judging each other. And that, for me, has really been the highlight of this consultation process. I think Mr. Speaker, two discordant notes really did stand out to me in the context of the debate, which I thought were an aberration in an otherwise robust but very constructive case of the debate. And I think, Mr. Speaker, that there is absolutely no room in Gibraltar whatsoever for us to consider that any person is ill or disabled because of a sexual orientation, as one considers that the GDP News program said. Similarly, Mr. Speaker, I do not believe that it is acceptable that there is any room in Gibraltar for somebody to refer to the religions of others in the context of this debate as a Bronze Age religion, as one correspondent said in the letter page of Panorama. Because we are a community that is defined by its respect, not tolerance, its respect for the views of each other. And that is exactly what Section 9.1 provides, that no person shall be hindered in the enjoyment of his freedom of conscience. And if we get there, you can speak and you can say whatever you like about somebody else's religion and about somebody else's belief. Of course you can. But discretion is sometimes the better part of valor when it comes to those issues. Mr. Speaker, one man's food is another man's poison, and I don't think that's ever been sure in the sense of a debate on a law when engaged in relation to this matter. And that's why, Mr. Speaker, on this issue, I wanted to be explicit that everybody on this side of the House will be voting their consciences. I say it's explicit because all members must remember that it is implicit in every single vote. whether it's a matter relating to financial services or it's a matter relating to morality. On this side of the house, everybody always votes their consciences, but in this instance, I think it is important that we be explicit in saying that. Mr. Speaker, one of the determining factors of the debate has been how this law interplays with the law on civil partnerships. I have heard time and again statements to the effect that what does the gay community, as some of you say, want, given that they have everything that they need now in the context of civil partnerships? Well, Mr. Speaker, it is true that civil partnerships were akin to marriage in just about every way possible, and that the government did not offer a defense in the context of a case on homosexual same-sex adoption in the Supreme Court. And therefore, with civil partnerships and with that decision, the architecture of same-sex relationships and the architecture of opposite-sex relationships was in effect identical, other than in the nature thing. And that is one of the things that was consistently put to us. But why did they, disclosing the Zamenhof aspect in some people's mentality, want more? They have everything already in civil partnership. It's just a word. Well, Mr. Speaker, therein lies the wrong. Because you see, it is a mighty double-edged sword, that argument, for those who say that we should not change this law in this way. Because if everything in substance has happened, if you take an attitude of substance over form, if everything in substance has happened in relation to same-sex relationships, that has to happen for them to be equal to heterosexual relationships, other than the nomenclature applied to the description available, then it's clear to me that those who are against this bill have lost the argument. Because they cannot argue that moral hell and brimstone will befall this community because of the nature of the relationship. Because as part of their argument to stop this bill, some have said, look, they've got everything, they have that in the context of civil partnership. That demonstrates that this debate has become just about a word. And look, this is going into the etymology of the word marriage, which this community has enjoyed better scholars than me, giving it a chapter and verse on for both sides. The fact is that we're just talking now about the word marriage. That is the reality. And so, if you're in a debate which is about form and not about substance, solve it quickly, because you are not going to need to be going for very long, because the horse is bolted, Mr. Speaker. And we have nowhere near the level of antipathy to the civil partnership act when it passed, that we found some teleport in the effect of this matter. Mr. Speaker, isn't it, though, incredible to reflect on how far we have come in less than 5 years since we became the government? It is not yet the 9th of December 2016. We have not yet been in government for 5 years. We have already legislated for civil partnerships, and we are now, I guess, about to see on the second reading what I hope will be unanimous support for this bill. From Speaker, those are 5 short years of very, very exciting changes. Mr. Speaker, that doesn't mean that the many years before them were not long and arduous for those who suffered those discrimination. And it's less, Mr. Speaker, than 1 year since we received the overwhelming mandate of the people in Gibraltar for us, the strongest foundation manifesto. Less than a year since then, we are implementing the manifesto commitment, bringing the bill to the House for debate on a second reading.
And the Speaker, as I said, everybody on this side will be voting their conferences, and therefore, Mr. Speaker, I will ask the clerk for a division of votes during the course of the second reading. There are no whips on this side, Mr. Speaker, neither three lines nor four lines. There never are, but it's important that people see about how we vote our conferences. And Mr. Speaker, just before I deal with my concluding remarks, I want to deal with the issue of Clause 6B. It's important in a community which is structured like ours is structured, where 955 people are against this measure and 1,368 are in favor, according to the responses to the consultation, that what we do is structured to ensure that we don't create new hostages to forces. Now, I've read, honourable members, section 9.1 of the Constitution. Now, 9.1 of the Constitution, in the view of the government, avails a public servant of a constitutional right not to be required to do something which is contrary to his conscience. And what we are doing, therefore, is ensuring that we provide not just for the right of equality of those who are same-sex couples, but also of the freedom of conscience of the public servant who may not wish to be involved in the, I use the word loosely, association of that particular union. Now, Mr. Speaker, the government comes to this as the main architect of the corporate receptive order, but also as the employer in the context of public servants. And in that sense, as a responsible employer, our role must be to ensure that we provide the service to the public, i.e., in this context, the same or opposite sex couples who wish to enter marriage at a civil level, and provide the protection for our employees with the freedom of conscience which the Constitution provides them not to be involved in that whilst they're being able to accede to the relevant post of deputy registrar or registrar. This strikes that balance, Mr. Speaker. This is not creating any discrimination because, you see, Mr. Speaker, in the goods and services cases, the bakers were denying the case. We're not going to do that. We are going to ensure that the deputy registrar or the registrar is there to marry those of same sex who wish to enter into those marriages. The government is the organization. The third parties are those who wish to enter the state of civil marriage. So they come to the government and they say, can I please have a cake? And the government says, after this change in the law, you will have the cake. But we cannot be told that inside the government, the cake must be baked by Joe or by Jerry, by Diane or by Dorian. It is a matter entirely for the government. The Chief Minister, the Chief Secretary, the Head of Human Resources, the Head of Department can move a civil servant who is a clerical grade overnight from one place to another. That is the way it's always been in the civil service. It's always been handled in that way. It is established practice in the civil service. Now, if there is a person who does not want to officially enter such marriages, they can simply be moved. But they might be quite happy to initiate other marriages. So the government, as an employer, is preserving the right of its employees who do not wish to do this to have access to the grade of deputy registrar, to be able to do the other marriages which they wish to do, and yet respect their 9-1 right not to do other things. And this happens across the board, by the way. There are many other examples of things that people are not required to do in the service because of their beliefs. There are people who don't work particular days because of their beliefs. There are people who don't count votes because they do not wish to do so. Nobody is compelled to do so. Now, because there are many examples in the service of that. And what the government believes is that it is absolutely right and proper that the Equality Rights Group, that
Those who are members of the 1368 who responded saying that they should be for marriage should insist that Gibraltar should provide equal marriage, and that we should do it in the same way as we do same-sex marriage. But nobody is entitled to be married in opposite-sex marriage by Joe or by Jerry, by Doreen or by Dennis. Nobody. A registrar turns up on that day. It will be the one with the black hair, the one with the ginger hair, the one with the blonde hair, whoever is available on that day is the person who officiates that civil ceremony. And that is what the government is going to ensure we do. We're going to provide the service. In the context of the goods and services cases, we are going to provide the cake. You can go into the baking shop and you can say, I want a baking shop from this shop. And you buy the baking, you buy the cake from that shop, because the goods and services registration provides for that. But you cannot say to the baker, and this must be baked by Joe and by Jerry, by Doreen and by Denise. You're not allowed to do that. You're just allowed to have a cake. They can outsource the provision of the cake, they can get Miriam to prepare the cake. That is the reality. I think I'm going to believe it's sitting in my head. But that is the reality of the legislation. And that is what the courts have provided for. But nobody should be denied service. There cannot be a denial of service. But there cannot, in the context of a public service, which is 4,000 people, civil service, which is half of that, there cannot be a law that says the same person must do the same thing for everybody else. If otherwise, we're the living in this understanding. People are just thinking that the Church of the Island, which is colloquially reported in sick on that particular day, they don't want to officiate a particular thing, or are going to fall back on their own right under 9-1. So this strikes the right balance, because we would provide absolutely the service that is required in order to provide equality to those who must have equal marriage, but we will not force it down anybody's throat that they must also officially those marriages, when I don't understand why, but they may have an objection to it. And the other way you need to understand that we do that as an employer, not just an employer, not just as a government movement would go to bring equality. Because there must also be an equal right to freedom of conscience. And if I may just round up on this point in this way, Mr. Speaker. If it's right for honourable members opposite to be able to vote their conscience, and it's right for us on this side of the House to vote our consciences, and the honourable lady has freedom of conscience and to vote against this bill if she wanted to, why must it not also be right that a civil servant should be able to have the freedom of conscience not to do something which he is a conscientious objector to? It's a blade that cuts both ways, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, and the honourable lady saying from the 7th position that we are allowing them to discriminate under our umbrella. Look, Mr. Speaker, what we are doing is ensuring that we respect our employees' freedom of conscience under 9-1 of the Constitution. Now, that's what we are required to do, by the way. We could do it in another way. We don't have to put it in the legislation. We could simply allow it administratively. But do you believe it is right to do it in this way? And I note, Mr. Speaker, I do note this, that he's leading the opposition in respect of this amendment, and that the honourable member is in a minority of, I don't know whether one or two in respect of that, but he's leading the opposition in respect of this amendment. I think he's got 3 votes out of 7. I don't know whether he's got 4, but I congratulate him for bringing an amendment which enjoys the support of other members of the Bank of Office, according to what they told us in the course of that speaking, they don't know whether they'll be prevailed upon as I would to vote in a different way or not and to put the amendment. Mr. Speaker, I want to now deal with the final part of my address by saying something of what His Lordship said in the context of the opinion piece in the Chronicle of the 8th of December, which I referred to earlier. Speaker, paragraph 12, 13, and 14 of what His Lordship said bear reflection. And I think, in large measure, where they are not dealing with His view of the substance of the issue, but whether they are dealing with the views on society and cohesion, I think they bear understanding. The voted says this: issues of religious freedom and freedom of conscience may arise in the future if there are no clear safeguards in the law which would accept marriage as applicable also to same-sex partnerships. It is hoped that the proposed law, if it goes through, will make sure that such issues will be clearly safeguarded, and such safeguards must apply not only to sacred places, church ministers and believers, but also to conscientious objectors and the use of property belonging to religious institutions or conscientious objectors, which I think deals with also the 63 points. Much has been written and said about the city, and at times antagonistic language and behaviour were evident. There is no place for such attitudes in a civilized society, and I am sure that Gibraltar is such a society where all may express their opinions in freedom, and there is reciprocal respect towards such opinions. Disagreement is not discrimination. People with different views of marriage will hopefully be able to express their beliefs and convictions without fear of intimidation or hostility, and that religious freedom and liberty will be supported and defended. We do not force people to agree with us, but we ask to be granted the same freedom to hold our beliefs. Gibraltar has always been looked upon as one big family with different religions and cultures living peacefully together. In spite of our different opinions and beliefs, it is my hope that all of us will continue to live together without hostile feelings alongside those whom we agree with the disagree, whatever the final outcome of the debate. I think those words from Bishop Smith are absolutely worth reflecting on, because they are entirely and absolutely correct as to the cohesion of this community of ours that we call the debate. Mr. Speaker, in the final analysis, love is love. And before anything else, that really must be what marriage is about. And if love is love, then who feels that love? Who they feel it for? What sex they are? And what sex the person that they feel it for is should not be a reason to deny today a description to one couple's love that is applicable to another couple's love. Today, as the bishop himself has recognized, this parliament is not interfering with any religion. We are not changing any sacrament or trying to alter the force of nature. Today, we are changing a law that got in the way of love. And in doing so, Mr. Speaker, we're doing the right thing. So, Mr. Speaker, I've been dying to say these words, and I hope that with our vote, all of us, not just one of us, all of us, by the power vested in us by the people of Gibraltar, we are moving forward to deliver marriage equality. And when we pass this bill, Mr. Speaker, and it becomes an act, then we will be able to say genuinely, we will be able to say honestly, we will be able to say truthfully, that was Section 15 of our Constitution has been proclaiming, but which our Lord has been denying. And I will therefore end, Mr. Speaker, exactly as I started, by quoting Section 15, because I believe after we vote, if the vote is in the affirmative, then Gibraltar will be a place where men and women of marriageable age shall have the right to marry and to found a family. But only then, Speaker, at last.
Does any other honourable member wish to contribute, or I will call the mover to reply?
Mr. Speaker, there is very little that I need to add now, following the words, particularly of the Chief Minister that we follow. The only issue between us, really, Mr. Speaker, has been the objection of those in the presidential to the proposed Section 16. and higher than by the leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker. And I just wanted to make it very minor point. The consultation process, Mr. Speaker, we heard from the Honourable Chief Minister, was a long one, a serious one, and one which we took in depth, because it was important for us to understand what the sense of feeling was in the proposal that we were going to put to the Parliament. Because, of course, it is a fundamental matter of equality when we were looking at extending the marriage, the principle of marriage to people of the same sex. And of course, Mr. Speaker, when we are looking at something that is so fundamental, we are not in the same breath going to discriminate against anybody. Because the point of this legislation is to eradicate discrimination. And we are the architects of our own law, Mr. Speaker. And in this process, we have had a very well thought out balancing between protection or between the expression that we find, which is enshrined in section or part 14 of the Constitution, and the protection that we find in 91, which the Chief Minister has explained to us already. 91 of the Constitution.
Just before one of the ladies developed a response in particular, I just wanted to ask a question and put forward a proposition in relation to the Dell versus the London Bar of Islington. That is the leading authority in the European Court of Human Rights that dealt with the issue of discrimination. And my understanding of the ruling by the European Court is in 2007 that the majority of the European Court held that Mrs. Dell was not discriminated against by the London Bar of Islington on the basis that she refused to conduct a ceremony of marriage. And so my view is that insofar as discrimination is concerned, our concern, I think that is at the end of the day, on this side of the house, that there are real deep concerns about the in terms of potential discrimination. And I wonder whether the early learning of the lady had a view in relation to that, given the authority in the day.
Mr. Speaker, just before I go away, I was referring to our Constitution, Mr. Speaker. And it's our Constitution that provides us, that provides the community with these fundamental rights and freedoms, Mr. Speaker. And it is our view that people are entitled to protection under 9-1 of the Constitution, Mr. Speaker. And furthermore, as the Honourable Gentleman is, I'm sure, aware, before a bill is brought to Parliament, we require it to have a certificate that tells it that it complies with the Constitution. So I do not agree with, I'm grateful for the point that was made in relation to nuclear legislation, Mr. Speaker. I am satisfied on the basis of the advice that we have that this bill does not infringe the Constitution.
There are certain matters that can be revisited in committee. I mean, I don't want this pulling and throwing when the mover is exercising her right to reply. This pulling and throwing, otherwise, we don't think the debate will finish it.
Because, Mr. Speaker, the point that I'm trying to make is that when we are designing this legislation and undertaking this balancing act, others agree with us as well, Mr. Speaker, that while, of course, the fundamental point that we are moving, Mr. Speaker,
I would be sincerely grateful if honourable members were to stop talking across the floor of the house.
Mr. Speaker, this is recognised by many, even by the Equality Rights Group, Mr. Speaker, who have publicly said, and acknowledge that the expression, that the freedom of religious expression is important. And Mr. Speaker, as you said, it may be something that may be more focused for us if it's going to lead to a discussion or a debate to the staff at the committee stage. The only other point that I wanted to make, Mr. Speaker, and perhaps cleaning up what's been said this morning, is the point made by the Honourable Leader of the Opposition, referring to a couple of pieces of legislation, Mr. Speaker. It is very clear from the bill, Mr. Speaker, that there are a lot of amendments, consequential amendments, that need to be made to legislation, which is why we have the power that we have in Section 4. Because not only do we have to make the consequential amendments to the legislation that we referred to, in fact, we have to make amendments to 33 pieces of legislation to ensure that all our legislation complies with this act so that it goes through. And Mr. Speaker, that is why I thought and I felt it important to single out the sterling work made by our lawyers in the legal drafting office. Because while what we see here in terms of the act of this proposed amendments to the Marriage Act and to the Matrimonial Causes Act, Mr. Speaker, there are amendments to 33 other pieces of legislation that need to be undertaken. And I know that that has been a tremendous piece of work that they have undertaken in a very short period of time. I have nothing further to add.
Since she finished on my preference for the fact that he was going to ask for a position, I think it ought to be made clear, and I am going to do so, that it is going to be recorded that two members are absent and that nothing should be read into that. It is in this Parliament, members, when they have to speak their next House vote, do not follow the practice of some other Parliaments where some members of Parliament who don't wish to vote in a particular way just absent themselves. Parliament. That is not the practice here. And the two members, one from the government and one from the opposition, who are not present in the chamber today, are unavoidably absent. And in fact, they did not know that this bill was going to come up this morning. It wasn't until earlier this morning that the Chief Minister gave me notice of the fact that the bill was going to be taken today and we informed members of the opposition. I think the position of members who are away, who are absent, has to be safeguarded. We don't want people sometime in the future to be reading into their absence something which is totally out of order. I now propose a question, and I need my glasses to come on. I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision for the marriage of same-sex couples and for collective purposes be read a second time. And the division has been quoted.
P.J. Baran.
Aye.
J.J. Bosano. R.M. Clinton.
Yes.
J.E. Fortes.
Aye.
M.S. Costa.
Aye.
D.A. Beaton.
Aye.
J.J. Garcia.
Yes.
M.D. Hassanon.
Yes.
G.H. Lukumi. S.E. Lunari.
Aye.
L.S. Yaman.
Yes.
E.J. Phillips.
Aye.
F.R. Picardi.
Yes.
E.J. Hayes.
Aye.
S.J. Sacramento.
Yes.
15 votes have been cast in favour, and there are 2 members absent, and therefore the bill is carried. The Civil Marriage Amendment Act 2016.
I would like to give notice that the committee stage on third reading of the bill is taken today. One honourable member of the
group. All honourable members agree that the committee stage on the third reading of the bill be taken today.
Then, Speaker, I'd be honoured to move that the House should resolve the second committee to consider the following bill called by four, that is to say, the Civil Marriage Amendment Bill 2016.
A bill for an act to make provisions for the marriage of same-sex couples and for connected persons. Clause 1.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 2.
A notice has been circulated of an amendment which the Honourable Madeleine Hassan now wishes to remove. Preference has been made in the course of the second reading. The matter has been debated, but there is no reason why now in committee the matter cannot be revisited. And the Honourable Lady is to so wish it, and I speak again in support of the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I never in my wildest dreams, as a traditional Jewess that I am, thought I would ever find myself quoting the New Testament. But today, I thought this quote was especially pertinent. From Galatians 3:28, there is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Jesus Christ. Mr. Chairman, in my earlier response, I stated that the principle behind this bill aims to right a grievous wrong. This amendment has the same intention. Members of this House should not be comfortable with the fact that a bill with these aims should effectively grant a license to discriminate. What does it say to our community about the commitment and conviction behind this bill that the access to equal rights that motivates this legislation is in itself denied by it? Is it not saying, Mr. Chairman, that as a House we are so insecure about the principle of same-sex marriage that we are willing to grant the government's own employees the right to not observe one of our own laws? Does this not devalue the bill? Does this not raise doubts about our commitment to end discrimination? Does this paradox fit easily with members, some of whom have flown the flag for an equality that we are now calling into question? Is there actually such a thing as a little bit of equality? Mr. Chairman, I ask the House, could this not be seen by the people of Gibraltar as more of a cop-out than an opt-out? Such a question, Mr. Chairman, seems justified, especially in the light of the Equality and Human Rights Commission's recommendation to UK MPs that a clause like the one that is being proposed would represent a breach of human rights. As a result, governments in England, Wales and Scotland decided not to exempt ready trials. In their view, religious views do not override other freedoms, including the right to equal marriage. Italy adopted a similar approach, and while there was naturally some resistance, these nations persevered with the conviction that this was the right thing to do. This may only apply to jurisdictions outside Gibraltar, but should human rights not be a universal constant unrestricted by frontiers? What is more sacred, Mr. Chairman, than our rights as human beings? Even in Northern Ireland, where equal marriage is not even yet legal, the rights of gay individuals are still respected and protected, as was the case only a few days ago when an appeal court in Belfast ruled that a bakery had discriminated against a gay customer by refusing to bake a cake featuring a slogan that endorsed the very act of equal marriage that we are making legal today. Their ruling stated that the principles of equality should not be changed to suit religious arguments, and yet we are making that particular allowance today. Should Gibraltar be playing catch up, Mr. Chairman, on an issue as important as fundamental human rights? And where do we go from here, Mr. Chairman? Are we, for example, going to allow registrars to refuse to marry divorced individuals, given that this is allowed by law, but clashes with some religious doctrine? Can a Jewish registrar deny conducting a civil marriage where a Jew is marrying outside the faith because his religion forbids this? This may be allowed by law and by the Constitution, but it does not happen because it is wrong. We should not be drawing arbitrary lines on issues of equality, Mr. Chairman. I am a person of faith, Mr. Chairman, but I am also a person of compassion, and I do not believe that my religious views, which might not be shared by others, should dictate how they should live their lives, where it has no impact on how I live mine. I also believe, as I think all proponents of modern democracy should, that church and state are two separate entities, and the agendas of the former should not always be the same as the latter. Later on in this parliamentary session, we will be discussing the issue of co-education. How ironic that the decision to separate boys and girls at secondary school, a decision that was partly influenced by the church, is over 40 years later being contested on the same session that we are allowing similar influences to shape another decision. Let us not make the same mistake again. The law should never be allowed to discriminate, Mr. Chairman. After all, according to the Treaty of Utrecht, I shouldn't even be here. And neither should all of Jewish or Muslim faith. And yet, 300 years later, this bill, as it currently stands, seems to recognize that one section of our community is not entitled to the same treatment as others. Instead, the law should embrace one common to all belief systems, be it in one God, many gods, or no God at all. And that is the law of tolerance. And it is in this spirit that I lend the full weight of my conscience and humanity towards supporting this amendment. And I urge all my parliamentary colleagues to do likewise. And if this amendment doesn't go through, Mr. Chairman, I shall be sad about the message that this bill will be sending, that it is acceptable for a person to discriminate against another by denying them a service they are employed to provide. I shall be dejected about the fact that we will be communicating to our gay community that they will not be entitled to the fair treatment that this bill aims to ensure, that it is fine to see them as lesser class citizens against the very principles of our Constitution. I would be concerned about the precedent this could set, and I would be disturbed by what it suggests about us as parliamentarians, as human beings. Mr. Chairman, truly, moral backbones should not be allowed to buckle that easily. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, I would like to say that irrespective of my amendments being passed or not, on the balance of the predicament currently facing gay members of our community, I wholeheartedly support this bill in recognition of the fact that it represents a significant step forward in our maturity as a nation. And while a decision not to delete this clause would fail to fully address some of the injustices in our society, I hope and pray that with time, perseverance, and especially tolerance, we will eventually arrive at a Gibraltar that is truly for all. Thank you.
The spirit of the government was not minded to accept the amendment we have already put in initially. If we had to be persuaded to definitely not support it, she has just managed to do that completely. Because for her to suggest, if we are somehow, by not accepting her amendment to our law to create equal marriage, creating a lesser class of citizenship amongst our gay community, and that we're somehow communicating that is unethical with respect to us, creating embarrassment for Gibraltar. Gibraltar is not going to create a lesser class of citizens or in some way communicate to gay members of the community unless they are. What we are going to do is we're going to ensure that the government of Gibraltar, which is what this side of the House represents, stops discriminating against people when it comes to entering into equal marriage. And we are going to provide that service using any one of the 2,200 civil servants employed by the government to do so. Now, it may be, Mr. Speaker, that the Chief Secretary could carry out these marriages, or it may be, Mr. Speaker, a junior member could carry out these marriages. But who is Deputy Registrar at the point when the marriages come to be celebrated is a matter entirely for the Chief Secretary. To say that by trying to walk the tightrope of these very difficult issues, we are incurring many of the things that the Honourable Lady has just read about that we're incurring in, is to pretend that she lives in a world where Section 9(1) of the Constitution does not apply. Now, the preservation of the right of freedom of consciousness is not the preservation of the right to inequality. Everybody must be treated in the same way. Of course they must. But the other thing you need to understand, we are employers as well as being government. As a government, we bring here, as the executive, a law to pass in order to allow equal marriage. We are the first government in the history of Gibraltar to do that in the context of a government bill. We are the trailblazers, the leaders, the deliverers of equality. And to hear that because we want to also protect our freedom, our employees, a freedom of consciousness, we somehow are the ones who are making gay members of our community who have never been availed of any assistance or support in the context of this issue until we've been elected. Making them somehow less of a citizen really lets the Honourable Lady down. Look, I know that in the sharing with people, she needs to look for relevance, she needs to look for arguments that raise her above the parapet. She has certainly done that today because she sees not the support of some members on the bench of opposition where the leader of the opposition does not take the same view as they do. That's all very good in terms of politics, but this is about much more than just politics. This is about whether we deny government employees the operation of Section 9(1) of the Constitution. Now, we have to deliver to the those who are arguing for equal rights, those equal rights. This bill at last does so. This government has delivered where no other government has delivered. Our manifesto promised to do that, where the one that she defended at the general election didn't even mention it. But you have to do it in the context of the constitutional architecture in which we operate, which provides for that freedom of conscience also to be protected in respect of your employees. You could take a different attitude. You could say, look, if you're not prepared to do this, I don't allow you to accede to the grade of Deputy Register. Well, look, Mr. Speaker, that would be to deny somebody advancement simply because of their own conscience. Look, I don't defend that view. I don't think it is fair, proper, or in any way defensible to have a view that you don't allow yourself to be used to officiate those marriages. I think it's nonsense. But if somebody has them, I also think many other views that people have are nonsense, but they're free to have them. The Constitution provides for that. Now, let me turn it round for the Honourable Lady. If she's saying with her amendment that government employees will be lesser employees because they will not be entitled, like every eligible territory, to the protection of Section 9(1), or that they have to leave government employment in order to do so. I mean, Mr. Speaker, when you subject the argument to logical scrutiny, it's embarrassing. Because, look, there's one thing that she has to accept, and that is the Constitution. She can like my arguments, she cannot like my arguments, whatever. We usually quite like each other's arguments. But in the context of this that she is putting now, she has to understand the ground rules. She cannot undo, with her rhetoric, Section 9(1) of the Constitution. Because that is what would lead to inequality and to some people being lesser than others. If you take away the right of freedom of conscience from people, now, you respect that right, and you respect their employment, and you say, okay, you won't have to do this. But I am definitely going to do it. My government is definitely going to deliver that equal marriage. In the context of what you said about cake, we are going to deliver the cake. We are a bakery that will deliver a cake to whoever arrives asking for a cake, whatever makeup of orientation to the way may be. I am committed to that. The government is committed to that. We've all voted that we are committed to that.
But what they cannot do is speak from benches opposite, and I note that the Honourable Leader of the Opposition has said, well, I delay his brother's change of mind, you know, has said in the course of the second meeting that he agrees with us, and perhaps for different reasons, but what cannot be done is that we can be told who has to officiate the marriage. It has to be one of those people who has been deputy registrar, and we can be forced to do so. It is the most logical way of doing so, Mr. Speaker, to have an exception, as we have here, that simply allows people who, because of their conscience, don't want to do this, not to have to do it. Although we think they would be wrong to have those pangs of conscience, and that they would be failing to see that equality is best delivered in a way that is seen through the sexual orientation of the people who turn up to marriage. But some of the things that the Honourable Lady has said, she has to make herself accountable for goodness sake. Gibraltar survives on the basis that human rights are international and apply across the board everywhere. We rely on our right to self-determination, our international human rights, to simply respect one of our employees' own fundamental rights under Section 91 of the Constitution, whilst accepting our obligation to deliver the service, is not to somehow create a chasm in respect of human rights. Now, if honourable members are just doing good for politics, they are going to go for a huge disservice if they're just doing good for politics. If they are doing it for another reason, I implore them to better understand Section 91 of the Constitution and what it is that it says and what it is that it sets up, and to think of themselves as employers in the context of this debate, as employers under Section 91, who have the obligation to respect that right for the people who are employed for them. And as probably the best employer in town, the government is going to respect the Section 91 rights of its employees. And therefore, we will not accept your amendment. Mr. Chairman, I heard a lot about the Constitution this morning. I did read it myself, my own contribution to the debate. And we're hearing a lot about Section 91 and the government's duty of care, it appears, to employees not to infringe on their consciences. But unless the government intends to legislate across the board for all its employees in any capacity, whether they be cleaners, doctors, lawyers, any other person employed by them, for them to exercise their freedom of conscience. And reading Section 9.1, what it says is, except in their own consent, no person shall be hindered in the enjoyment of his freedom of conscience. Now, I will also defer to my learned colleague to my right, the Honourable Edward Phillips, where he quotes the Liddell case, which went to the European Court. And you will correct my memory, but my memory was that the ruling was the individual was not being hindered in enjoyment of their freedom of conscience. And again, the Chief Minister refers constantly to Section 91, but ignores Section 95. And what Section 95 says, nothing contained in or done under the authority of any law should be held to be inconsistent with or in contravention of, and I quote, subsection 1 or 3, to the extent that the law in question makes provision A, in the interest of defense, public safety, public order, public morality, or public health, or B, for the purpose of protecting the rights and freedoms of other persons, including the right to observe and practice any religion or belief without the unsolicited intervention of persons professing any other religion or belief, except so far as that provision, or as the case may be, the thing done under the authority thereof is shown not to be reasonably justifiable in a democratic society. And I would like to pause on Section 5b. Nothing done in the authority of any law should be held to increase in contravention of subsection 1 and clause b for the purpose of protecting the rights and freedoms of other persons. But how do you reconcile inserting clause 6b with subsection 5b of the Constitution? Otherwise, any individual in the employment of government could likely turn around to their supervisor and say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to serve this divorcee because it's against my conscience.
That cannot be right. As a former employer, how could I in the bank allow an employee to say, no, I don't want to deal with that person because it's against my religious beliefs? By inserting this clause, and to this extent, I agree with the Honourable Lady, is you are more or less condoning a form of discrimination. You're not protecting somebody's conscience. You're actually enshrining legislation the right to discriminate. And this is what I don't understand. I know this is not politics. This is what I do not understand. Why the government feels they need to insert this clause. It's far be to protect the employees, and if that was the case, they would be doing it across the board on all legislation, not just this one. So again, I will be supporting the Honourable Lady's amendment because I do not see how it is abhorrent to not have this clause in terms of Section 9.1 of the Constitution. Section 9.5 of the Constitution applies exactly to the protection of rights and freedoms of other persons. If you insert Section 9b, you will do the exact opposite. And so, Mr. Chairman, I will be voting in favour of the Lady's amendment.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think that the offer of the Honourable Gentleman has said is just a complete nonsense in the context of 9.1 and 9.5. But the debate that we are having is on the subject of this bill. The only thing before the Parliament is this bill. There is not before the Parliament a law about who collects whose rubbish. There is not before the Parliament a law about any other aspect of what the government does as a municipality or as a government. Just this issue of equal marriage. That's why we're only doing it in relation to marriage. Because if it came up in some other area, we might agree to protect our employees also in that way. I would have said, why are you doing it only in relation to this? Well, I would have thought that that was blinding the obvious, because that is what we are dealing with today. And in case he doesn't understand what it is that is the hindrance that people might suffer with, very simple, Mr. Speaker. The hindrance is that they may not be able to access that job with that grade, with that salary, unless they are prepared to forego their freedom of conscience and officiate marriages which they are not prepared to officiate. I would have thought that much was obvious. 9.5 is there to protect against a clash of freedoms. And that is exactly what we are doing with 6B. In other words, if one wants to express one's freedom of speech by going out and insulting people, the others don't know there are laws which restrict that if you incur in libel or in slander. So there are laws that protect against clashes of freedom. Now, does the Honourable Gentleman want to set up a society where you say, right, you are free to do this, and you are no longer free to say that you will not be a party to it? I want to set up a society which is truly free, where both an individual is entitled to all of the same rights that anybody else is entitled, and other individuals who are involved in the provision of that, so long as the service continues to be provided, cannot be singled out to be the ones that must provide it. And that is what we're doing. We're walking that tightrope to both ensure a landmark change in our law, which delivers the service to members of our same-sex community, of marriage, to them, which they have long been denied, which I was initially against, and I'm now in favour of it. There's a lot of all the things I told honourable members for all of the reasons that have been delayed in Gibraltar. At last, there is a government that's going to deliver that full equality, and at the same time, we're not going to force some of our employees to be the officiators of that because we'll respect their Section 9.1 rights. Speaker, I don't know that the Honourable Gentleman has said anything about 9.1 and 9.5 that requires any other response. I would have thought it's blindingly obvious in reading the two sections that, in particular in the context of being an employer, one has to protect the 9.1 rights, especially if you can deliver the services we have all agreed have to be delivered under Section 15. I give the Honourable Gentleman the same example I gave the Honourable Lady, because I think they're not getting it, so I explain it in terms of the case involving the cake. You walk into the bakery, whatever sexual orientation you are, you're entitled to bake the cake. You're not entitled to tell the baker, I want the cake that has been baked by the fifth cook from the back, the sixth from the left.
There is a cake on show. It's available. You can have the cake. I think it's wrong not to tell people cake because of their sexual orientation. But you know, there are people also who have the right to be protected in the way that they exercise their freedom of conscience, however much we may completely disagree with them. And not just in the context of structuring the community of government, but as an employer. And that is the difference that the Honourable Gentleman has to appreciate as an employer, as a public sector employer. I provide services to the general public. If you're working in the bank, you provide services to who you like. You don't have to provide them to everyone. We must provide the same services to absolutely everyone in this community. And no one, heterosexual or homosexual, same-sex or opposite sex, is able to go into a registry and say, I want to be married by Dorian the Blonde. You just put your name down to be married, and somebody turns up and marries you. And what the Honourable Gentlemen are saying, what the Honourable Gentlemen lady is saying, is that we must force a particular individual to marry those who are of the same sex. And that, Mr. Speaker, is just entirely wrong and unacceptable.
I hope that in the contribution that Honourable Members make in the existing committee, they would not just repeat the same argument again and again and again, because otherwise we are not getting anywhere. I do not hear any first argument either on one side or on the other. I don't want to curtail debate, but let us not repeat ourselves.
Mr. Speaker, just on Mr. Chairman, just on that point, I indicated in my speech that I took the view that 60 was offensive, and therefore I believe that I have a reason right to mention this issue again and speak on the amendment, that my honourable friend has mentioned. But I would just say one thing. We don't dispute, of course, I don't dispute that the government is an employer, but an employer has to take tough decisions. And quite frankly, where you have a civil registrar, a married registrar, who is effectively conducting an entirely secular role, I think it is wrong for a civil registrar or registrar in Gibraltar to say that I will not marry that individual, and the government to create, by way of legislation, a mechanism for them for the appointment of another deputy registrar. How would a gay person going into the registrar say, please marry me, oh, I'm sorry, I can't marry you, but we'll get someone appointed for the purpose of the law to marry you, because I feel that my freedom of conscience is being engaged. Frankly, I don't agree. I think 60 is offensive, and I think that it should be removed. And I would agree with the Honourable Lady that her amendment should be approved by the House. I don't know which 9-1 the Honourable Gentleman read. 9-1 that says people shall only have the freedom of conscience when dealing with issues of morality or of religion. I haven't read in 9-1 anything that says people shall have freedom of conscience except when they're dealing with issues which are secular. I mean, that is an invention of the Honourable Gentleman. Everything is secular, even the moral and the religious. You're dealing with the today. You're dealing with decisions that are being made today. People's protection is there for everything that they do. Now, if you take a job, look, I would expect that people who now take a job as deputy registrar will know that they're likely to be asked, in some instances, to appreciate same-sex marriages. So if they take the job in future, you might even argue that they're villains if they keep the job. But you know, at the moment, there are people there. Some of them may or may not agree. They've not had a discussion. I don't want to make a judgment about whether people there are or are not prepared as a matter of conscience to enter into to officiate these marriages. But for the Honourable Gentleman to say, because the matter is secular, then 9-1 doesn't apply, look, it's absolute and utter nonsense. And the idea that people, gay people, he says, are going to turn up and are going to be told by the God are not going to be married by them, look, that also, with respect to the Honourable Gentleman, is a cartoon version of what happens. Look, what happens is that people who wish to enter a civil marriage, they're in a form. They submit it, and they're told when the form is verified and the fee is paid, okay, we have a slot tomorrow at 3, or we have a slot this afternoon at 6. It's about slots. And they turn up, and the person who will be there will be a person who is prepared to officiate that marriage. So no gay person, no lesbian person, no bisexual person, no transgender person, no transsexual person, I think I've got the name, is going to turn up and be told they're not going to be married. Far from it. or that this person is not going to marry them. They are creating an edifice of potential discrimination, which is just not there. What we are doing is ensuring, as an employer, that when the form comes in, we don't say, ah, Mr. X, you don't want to do same-sex marriages because you are always against them for whatever issue of religion or conscience or whatever. You must do it. And as I don't like you and I'm your boss, you must do it. And when you say you won't, you will be subject to a discrimination because you will be demoted or there will be a black mark on your file. We, as an employer, are ensuring that doesn't happen. But not in a way that is going to create for a person of the LGBTQ community any rejection or anything like that. Because we would never allow that. And if that's what were happening, we would have championed the cause that they are pretending to champion now. But that is not going to happen. We're going to ensure that every LGBTQ person who turns up, went into a same-sex marriage, has the service of that same-sex marriage officiated for them, and we have a first government in the history of Gibraltar to lead on that and deliver on that. But at the same time, we're going to protect our employees' freedom of conscience.
Mr. Speaker, let's be clear about my own position, which the Honourable Deputy Minister has made every attempt at in the committee. I am going to be voting against the amendment. I don't vote against the amendment for the reasons that the Honourable the Chief Minister put forward, which is that by not including this amendment, the human rights contained in 9(1) in the Constitution of public servants might be infringed by forcing, by not allowing them to basically opt out of a ceremony. And the reason why I don't even go there is because the matter has already been determined by the European Court of Human Rights, which contains exactly the same provision as in our Constitution. Because what happened in Labour was that this lady refused to perform a civil marriage to gay people, and she was sacked. She sued for unfair dismissal, her claim was dismissed, and then she went to the European Court of Human Rights, saying, my human rights have been infringed because I refused to perform this marriage on the grounds of my religion. And the European Court of Human Rights said, well, no, there's a balance here. There's somebody else who has also human rights, and you can't refuse to perform the marriage. So I don't oppose the amendment on the grounds that the government opposes the amendment. I oppose the amendment because I think it is wrong to force on public servants to perform gay marriage in circumstances, Mr. Speaker, let's not forget, where a girl was actually sacked for refusing to perform a gay marriage. I was saying in this House that a public servant that refuses to perform a gay marriage ought to be sacked, because there's no way in a million years that I would stand up for any such law, Mr. Speaker. No way, Mr. Speaker, that I would stand up for that law. And that is the reason why I am opposing this amendment. Because in a tolerant, in a respectful, in the kind of society that Gibraltar, that we live in Gibraltar, where we are respectful of each other, we should not be forcing upon people who have their own religious beliefs and their own rights of conscience to perform a gay marriage in circumstances where, as the Chief Minister has quite rightly pointed out, somebody else is going to be performing it, and therefore no one is going to be deprived of the right to basically to marry. And let me just end with this point. The Honourable Lady has mentioned the Irish bakery case, as indeed I did in the course of my contribution. I read with interest, Mr. Chairman, a contribution by Peter Tatchell in the Daily Telegraph, who, for many people, was actually the main activist in favour of gay marriage in the United Kingdom, actually saying that cases like the Irish bakery cases that it's wrong, that he regrets the fact that the law has actually been pushed that far into a situation where those who bake a cake in a small bakery can be sued for refusing to provide a cake to a wedding ceremony on grounds of religion. And come on, Mr. Chairman, what kind of a society would we live in today? In those kinds of claims, we are allowed now to vote, Mr. Speaker. But secondly, I am not standing up to any amendment that could possibly to lead to that kind of situation, because in Gibraltar, we pride ourselves in our openness, and we pride ourselves in the fact that we look together and that we respect each other. And therefore, I agree entirely with the government that this clause is opposite and this clause ought to be included.
Well, I really don't know who the Honourable Gentleman has agreed with, but I think I should thank him for saying that he agreed with us, although he started saying that he didn't. Because he didn't his interpretation of the bill is not one that we share, for the reasons that he came on to when he said that he supported the text of the 6B. Because the bill was fired. And this amendment ensures that nobody would be fired. But exactly, the article is exactly when, in fact, the servant in question of an entity, public or otherwise, in that case, had to go through a legal case of unfair dismissal in order to protect the position that she should have been entitled to. And Mr. Speaker, our view is there has to be clear protection in our law for employees in that respect, whilst at the same time delivering the service. And where I don't think we agree, Mr. Speaker, is in relation to the case. Because we take the view that the case should be delivered. The case should be delivered. It's just that you can't require the baker to be, or the baker shop, to have that particular baker bake it for you. So, perhaps, unusually, Mr. Speaker, I'd be grateful for the support, although I entirely disagree with the reasoning. Usually, it's both. But in this instance, at least, it's the support that I welcome, but not the reasoning.
I just have one question to ask, which I can't actually understand, to do with providing that service. If a heterosexual couple attends a council, files the form, and they get offered certain slots perhaps in the following day, but then a homosexual couple, a gay couple, goes and fills in the same form, but perhaps does not get offered the next day because it's not a deputy registrar available on the next day. What would happen in this occasion? Well, it's a hypothetical, but perhaps I'm grateful for the other gentleman's practical question. Notifications are usually after 21 days of the marriage, or a time to plan. We have 6 registrars. We anticipate that we'll be able to fill every slot 6 times over every day. We have enough couples. I don't know whether we're allowed to call them that. Enough rooms in which to officiate civil marriages rather than chapels in which to do them. So, at a practical level, nobody is going to be even delayed because there may or may not be a registrar who wishes or does not wish to. Can I just say, for the purpose of the record, no deputy registrar has evinced to us any suggestion that they don't want to do same sex marriages at the civil level. So, nobody should think that there is a person at the civil registration office who doesn't want to do this. This is a matter of theory, of legal theory, to protect potential putative employees, not actual complaints of concern from anybody who is not prepared to bake the cake.
If a registrar refused to marry a couple because the couple is black or his religion forbids them to, are there provisions in the law for such, or is this just law just for sexual orientation?
There's specific provision in our law in that respect, because the Constitution provides a protection against discrimination on the grounds of race, and there would be an action against the government or the employer or the individual for that discrimination. As the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister indicated in the earlier intervention that he made, there is no specific protection in our law on the grounds of sexual orientation. There is a law in that suggests that the word sex in the Constitution means sexual orientation in some instances, but the words sexual orientation do not appear in our Constitution as a ground for actionable discrimination, because Mr. Bassani and the only Bassani alone, Mr. Rakhir, weren't able to prevail upon those who were in the Select Committee at the time, none of whom are now here, to include that word, which I am quite happy to tell you, as a lady, we shall be speaking in the context of the new Constitution, should be included. Then there would be an inbuilt, actionable discrimination on sexual orientation grounds without needing to rely on external jurisprudence. There isn't at the moment, but there is on the grounds of race, there is on the grounds of religion, etc.
So, is this something that you will be looking at in the constitutional reform?
Well, unless the Honourable Lady is turning me down, I mean, I've suggested that we should look at it together in the context of the Select Committee that you seem to be invited to form a part of. And what I do is I'm giving notice that one of the things I will certainly be doing is that I believe, as my colleague, Dr. Rafael Mector and the Honourable Mr. Bassano believe at the time of the 1999 Select Committee, that this is an issue that must be in the body of the Constitution itself explicitly as sexual orientation.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, Chief Minister, because I don't find myself able to wade in on the legal arguments. There are enough lawyers here, and I am not one of them. But for me, this is a matter of morality, and it was not in order to find a form of relevance from my lonely chair. It was more about principle, and at least to know that the Chief Minister considers it a point that could be used as a discussion and perhaps hopefully to move in constitutional reform. Committees and decisions would be a great thing for us, I think.
Mr. Chairman. Going back to the Constitution and the protection against discrimination and grounds of race, orientation, etc. Section 14.2 subsection 6, 7, and 8, no person shall be treated in a discriminatory manner by any person acting in the performance of any public function conferred by any law or otherwise in the performance of the functions of any public office or any public authority. Section 3 goes on, in this section, the expression discriminatory means affording different treatment to different persons. I won't bore them up by reading the rest of the included sexual orientation. I mean, how does the Chief Minister reconcile this to his supported concern to protect people's freedom of conscience? When everything our Constitution says is saying, don't discriminate against minorities. I think it's so obvious that I suppose that you haven't asked the authority to demonstrate what your understanding is of the Constitution. You must have asked you wantingly to give him an explanation. What I'm going to do is because I'm sure that you don't put a public sector employee in front of people who are looking for a service from the government who is not able in all conscience to discharge that function in order not to incur in the area which that section deals with. In other words, we're not going to have a public sector employee, civil servant, put in a situation where he feels, because of his conscience, he has to discriminate and say to them, I will not marry you, whatever the law provides. That is the position. And we're not going to discriminate against those who tell us that they would be put in that position. Now, the Honourable Member's various emanations of physical faces that I've been treated with since he was elected in November last year continues to entertain us. But it's very simple. That's what the section provides. You cannot, if you're a public servant, discriminate against somebody in the context of discharge of your public office. So, we are not going to put a public servant in that position. We're going to allow them not to be put in that position, and another public servant will be put in that position, who will not incur in that discrimination. Although, I must tell him, that it's not the Constitution that gave rise to equal marriage, it's the actions of this government with our manifesto, which demonstrates that we're the ones who really cared about this subject, with our consultation and with our government's bill. That is going to end the discrimination, not in the operation of the
I have the right to accede to that marriage. And in the context of 9-1, what we're doing is allowing through 6b that the person who stands in front of that couple does not incur in that discrimination.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I follow his logic, if there was somebody, if he decided to pass a law amendment where somebody decided that they didn't like people's colour, language, creed, or something else, then they would remove him from that position, so they have to effectively breach the section of the Constitution. And is that not what he's saying?
Mr. Speaker, I've explained it so many times, over and over again, that my answer to the Honourable Gentleman is to go back and read the Hansard over and over again, as many times as he likes, and to put down his base friend for a while and enjoy rereading this debate over and over again, because I've already provided the answer over and over again.
Mr. Chairman, I'm here in a constructive frame of mind, trying to make sure we pass the best possible legislation for people to vote in. All I get from the Chief Minister are comical remarks and nothing constructive. Now, he has the benefit of an Oxford degree in law, which I don't have, so I, as most people in the world, will have to read the Constitution as a layperson. So, essentially, that's all I am when it comes to the Constitution. But it seems obvious to me, although it's not obvious to him, that what he's doing, the government's effective, is not condoning discrimination. It's as simple as that. And Mr. Chairman, seeing as my contributions are not valued by the Chief Minister or anybody else in that side of this House, I will end my contribution as well.
Mr. Speaker, I don't think I've ever heard such an attempt to make a person a victim in this House as I have
heard before. Could I ask honourable members, today has been a very well overall, the standard of debating has been excellent, and all the parliamentary proprieties required by the rules have been observed. Could I please ask them to stick to that standard?
Yes, Speaker. And as I was saying, the other gentleman has attempted to make a victim of himself simply because he apparently wants me to explain over and over again what certain parts of the Constitution mean. Well, look, Mr. Speaker, there are a number of lawyers on his side of the House. He's heard on a number of occasions what their views are in relation to 9-1. I would have thought he had more regard for their views than he has for mine. He can go back and read them all in the handset, but he is not paid by the public and the voters to just keep asking us the same question all over again, every 5 minutes, and make the same rhetoric. We take a different view. We are not creating a discrimination. We are at last, from this side of the House, undoing a historic discrimination. We are trailblazing, and we are the first movers in this. Otherwise, I might ask him, why didn't he prevail upon people on the other side to put in their pamphlet at the last general election anything to do with same-sex marriage? Because if they come here and talk about wanting to protest against discrimination being created, etc., what he should have done is done that in the executive committee and put something in his manifesto that we put in ours. That's what they would have done if they really cared. Not pretend here to be caring now about an issue which is a non-issue and which actually imperils civil servants. And I'm very pleased, actually, that the leader of the citizen takes a completely different view to him and a number of others. To see what number of others, and assuming that this is the last contribution in respect of this section, I would call for a division in respect of the vote in respect of this section of the amendment.
And I emphasize that to me, what is important here is that we should not be placing public servants in a position where public servants can potentially be sacked simply because their conscience, as Christians or Muslims or whatever, prevents them from performing this kind of service. And I think that in a small community like this also, that would be wrong, and that's the reason why I'm voting against them.
May I? The leader of the opposition has spoken about people being sacked. There is a code of register, isn't there? Not just a deputy register, there is a code of register, and therefore, in order, people would be applying for promotion to that code. And therefore, there is a danger. I'm saying this because of my knowledge, 13 years chairman of the PSC, where the government always tries to be a good employer, that people should not be inhibited from being able to apply for promotion, not just the fear of being set, but applying for promotion as well.
PJ Valran.
No.
JJ Vasano.
No.
R.M. Clinton.
Yes.
J. E. Cortez.
No.
N.F. Costa.
No.
D.A. Seaton.
No.
J.J. Garcia.
No.
M.D. Hassan Naon.
Yes.
E.H. Bukudi. S.E. Linares.
No.
Alex Yama.
Yes.
E.J. Phillips.
Yes.
F.R. Picardo.
No.
E.J. Reyes.
No.
S.J. Sacramento.
No. Yes. The amendment is defeated by 11 votes to 4. And therefore, clause 2 stands part of the bill.
The wrong title. Thank you, pardon.
Clause 3,
stand part of the bill. The wrong title, stand part of the bill.
Clause 3 stands part of the bill. Clause 4 stands part of the bill. The wrong title stands part of the bill.
Now I know why it's called a division. Yes. You can have the honor to report that the Civil Marriage Amendment Bill 2016 has been considered in committee and agreed to without amendment, and I now move that it be read a third time and passed.
I now put a question, which is that the Civil Marriage Amendment Bill 2016 be read a third time and passed.
Those in favor? Those against, carried.
The speaker is a happy day for the voter. Equal marriage now applies to all in our community, and with an entreaty to honourable members not to celebrate too heartily, I move that the House to now adjourn until 2:30 this afternoon.
The House will now be set to 2:30 this afternoon.